Our guest is Richard Lamparski. He's author of a book titled Whatever Became Of, and then, of course, the various names that you might end that sentence with or that question. It's published by Crown Publishers. Actually, Mr. Lamparski is host and producer of a radio series entitled Whatever Became Of, and his book is based on that subject. Incidentally, the book has an introduction by Cleveland Amory, and there are over 200 photographs, that is then and now photographs, of people that many of us will remember. Certainly if you're on the wrong side of 40, I think you will know the names of just about all of them. And I understand recently, I don't know how recent it was, Richard, that you interviewed the gentleman, Jack, I'm just looking in the thing here. I can't even think of the name when he worked with the team. You know, he's always over at Louise's with us.
Oh, Jack Pearl.
Yeah, but I mean, what was the name he used?
Oh, Baron von Munchausen.
Yeah, that's right. Good Baron. Think of the Baron part.
The great,
yes.
The great liar.
About a year and a half ago, I interviewed Mr. Pearl.
Uh-huh. When did you interview Harry Richmond?
I didn't. I've spoken to him on the phone, but he's been in Hollywood since I've been operating in this area. But I've talked to him on the telephone.
Mm-hmm. Did you use the beeper tape on the air?
No, I just interviewed him for the book. There are many people in the book who I haven't interviewed on the air, and many people I've had on the air that I haven't put in the book.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about interviewing Harry Richmond? I mean, did you read his book recently?
Yes. I read it just before I wrote mine.
I think Dick Gaiman wrote it for him.
He ghosted it. Yeah. I think he got credit.
He got credit on it.
It didn't do very well, unfortunately. I talked to his publisher about another book they were thinking of bringing out, and because it didn't do well, they decided not to bring it out. As a matter of fact, I just had a letter yesterday from Busby Berkeley telling me that his book had been turned down, much to my surprise, by a publisher. And I wrote back and said, don't feel badly, because a number of the people who've been on my program has said, here's a manuscript, you know, would you take it to your publisher? People think if you have a book published, you know, you can get anything published.
Yes.
And it's kind of embarrassing because, you know, lots of times they get turned down. I'm embarrassed about it. But I was surprised they turned his down, but I think it was because these showbiz biographies they flooded the market, for one thing, and they just haven't been selling very well.
Well, I was a fan of Harry Richmond's for many years. I still like to hear him sing, as he did in the George White scandals and at Club Richmond. But I must admit, the book I thought was really embarrassing.
Well,
did you read it?
I read it. Yeah. Of course, I didn't know him very well, but a friend of mine, Lena Basquette.
I know Lena very well.
You know Lena.
I've known Lena very well.
I asked her about the book, and she said, I won't say exactly what she said because she's very frank. But she said it's wishful thinking as far as his love life goes, because I've known Harry from way, way back. And would that he could do those things. Always had a problem in that area.
That's a pretty good beginning.
Well, I mean, anybody wears a straw hat all the time. even in December, it's in a lot of trouble. I always told Harry, get rid of the straw hat, Harry, and you can make out.
That's a funny line, Danny.
Just wouldn't listen. I was embarrassed because I know Dick very, very well. Dick Gaiman's been on many times, and I think he's a very fine writer. I never actually met Mr. Richmond. I took photographs of him, and in taking photographs of him from movie magazines and things like that. I mean, you know, you're introduced, but it's a casual thing. You know, my name is John Neville, and I'm doing the set for so-and-so, and that's the end of the relationship. But I was really embarrassed where he related in the book his relationship with Clara Bow, and it wasn't even anything that might be to some people titillating. I thought it was in such poor taste, even if these relationships did happen in the manner which he suggests, with his bearskin rug and all. It was not to be put in a book. If he was writing a novel, and as you have indicated, evidently it was a novel, but he used real names. Just as I was very critical of Lita Gray Chaplin, did you interview her?
I was just about to ask you. Yes, I did interview
Same
her. You know,
problem.
How you felt about that
right.
about
I
that
thought
post.
That was, I told her so on two different shows that we did. I liked her as a lady. She
yes,
seemed to be
I did
a
too.
Very
She's good
delightful
interview.
Person. Wonderful.
Good
person
interview. Yeah. I asked her what her, you know, the children felt about it. I mean, a mother could write this about a man who is the father of her children.
That's
and,
right.
I don't know what the answer to it is. It's embarrassing, you're right.
What was her answer to that question? I hope they buy the book.
She didn't really give me an answer. I said, after I introduced her, I said, I've read your book. I'm one of these interviewers who reads books, and for shame. And she said, thanks for the plug.
That's right. She told me, I said to her, I thought it was a dirty book, and it was a book that shouldn't have been published by her. Now, if somebody else wrote it or something like that, that would be a different
thing.
Well,
it was Harlow that...
Well, Harlow didn't write the book.
It's very interesting that Lita Gray Chaplin didn't really bring you up to date in her book, if you notice, of what she really is doing now, because her publisher told me, which I won't go into on the air, but okay. I said to
well,
the girl...
she told us what she was doing. She's doing publicity, she said.
Well, I mean what her personal life is like today, because it would have made a very interesting chapter as long as she wants to bear her whole life. I thought the final chapter was most interesting.
The show, I mean the book... was not successful.
It wasn't? I don't know.
I mean, it's a financial success.
No.
Bernard Geis published it.
Yeah.
And it just didn't move. Let me ask you this. Do they call you Dick or Richard?
Richard, please.
Richard. How did you get started with this idea, this format? I think it's great to begin with. I think it's an excellent one.
Well, everyone asks me that. It's a very difficult question to answer. I can't say when it clicked in my mind, but for years, I was a press agent before I did this, I waited for someone else to do it. I thought it was such a natural idea that I thought, well, as soon as I get started, somebody with a name who's in the business will have done it, and it'll be a waste of time. But I just found myself with some time at one period in my life, and I wanted to do it, and I took the idea first to the radio station. People think that the book came first. It didn't. And without any selling at all on my part, I just mentioned the idea. They said, yes, start immediately. And I said, well, I don't really know if it will be very good on radio because people want to see what these people look like. And they said, well, try it. And from the mail we got, within about 2 or 3 weeks, we could tell it was quite popular, oddly enough, among young people.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book came from that.
Well, do you actually editorialize?
No, not at all.
In other words, it is merely an interview.
Merely an interview, yes. Yes, I never ask personal questions of any kind or answer them.
Do you ever, well, supposing that you were interviewing Harry Richman tonight,
mm-hmm.
and you had this comment from Lena Basquette, would you say to him during the course of the interview that I met Lena Basquette recently and she said that your book was a figment of your imagination?
No. But I would say, I might say that I found sections of your book rather embarrassing. And, would you have written that had Clara Bow been alive? I might ask him a question like that. And if he went into detail, I'd say, well, it has been questioned as to the truth of this.
Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to figure, was she still alive when the book came out?
No, she wasn't.
Well, you would know. I don't. I've forgotten. I understand now he is very ill.
Well, I talked to him, let's see, it would be in the spring, and it was very difficult, although we had a very clear connection, to understand what he was saying, because the voice was so bad, it was so raspy.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to Ted Lewis a couple weeks after that. I just happened to have been interviewing Ted Lewis, and I asked him if he still saw him. He said yes, that the friars, the lambs, one of them, had given a testimonial dinner.
That's right.
For him, mm-hmm. and... he had seen him out there. He said, you know, he's pretty well broke, and I don't think he's going to make any money on this this book. Well, he admits he's broke. I don't think I'm telling him.
No, he opens up. He said, I used to go around with two or three beautiful women on each arm. Now I go to the supermarket with a bag on each arm. And he means a shopping bag. He tells that story.
Humor about it,
yeah, in the Of course, we don't know if it's Dick Gayman's sense of humor or Richman's sense of humor. It's a beautiful opening.
Yeah.
And very tragic, because I don't think you're old enough to remember when the man was on top. There was a man by the name of Will Oakland who had what was known as Will Oakland's Terrace. on 51st Street between Broadway and 7th Avenues. And 7th Avenue, Broadway and 7th Avenue. And Will Oakland was an excellent singer, a very fine singer, not a trick singer, not a gimmick man. And I met Will about 2 or 3 years prior to the time that he died. I had, from time to time, been in the club but never knew the man or anything, that is, personally. And he told me at one time that there was a contest in the city of New York, and I don't remember the name of the paper at that time. I guess we had 8 or 10 newspapers. I think the title was The King of Song, and the public were being polled. And there was a coupon in the paper that you could write in, whether your favorite was Richmond or Will Oakland. And he indicated that they had discovered that there were an awful lot of ballots coming in favor of Richmond in one particular area, and he was not too happy about it. But however, it turned out that Will Oakland, who I think was a local success on radio and a local big name, and yet he really outdrew Harry Richmond as the King of Song, if that was the title, back around 1929 or 30. Will Oakland also died really broke. He came into a place of business that I had in New Jersey on the highway, and I was just doing a small half-hour show. I don't know why I say that small. Those are regular size shows, but after doing 5 hours for so many years, you think a half-hour is station break time. And this little show that I had at WOR from 11:30 to 12 at night, I never ran into anybody that ever heard it. Yet there must have been some listeners. And I had this big business out in Parsippany, New Jersey, where I had an auditorium that would accommodate just about 800, 1,000 people. In the standing room, and I would sell merchandise and entertain them with stories and selling and so on from about 7 at night till maybe 2 or 3 on a Saturday night going into Sunday morning. So there, while the people are gradually gathering in and a young man is up there selling some odds and ends to warm the people up, as they say, warm the tip up, this man came over to me and he said, you do a wonderful show. Well, I was just delighted that somebody had heard it. I was never sure whether the switch was in the on or the off position on the console. And he said, I used to be in radio, referring to himself. And I said, yes, what was your name? He said, well, you would never remember me. And I realized he was right, but whatever he said his name was, if he said, you know, Charlie Krell, I'd say, oh, sure, you know, Charles Krell, hoping he'd come back and say, remember when I used to sing and so on. So I said, what is your name? And he said, Will Oakland. Well, I did know the name and knew it very, very well. So I took him into my office, which was behind the auditorium, and sat down and talked with him a little while. And he was so delighted. It was, I guess it meant to him, like 1,000 people waiting at the stage door of the Capitol Theater did in 1929 when he appeared there looking for autographs or, you know, anything that he might give them. Just one person knowing his name. So he said to me, he said, you know, next Sunday I am going to be on the Ed Sullivan Show. Sullivan was doing one of those annual or semi-annual shows where he brings in old-timers. And I said, gee, that's great. And he said, yes. And he said, I've been shopping in your store for a long while, and I remembered having seen him before. What are you doing now? Well, he's starting Tuesday at Charlie Krell's bar on the highway. You know, this is a four-stool job and a piano player. And I said to him, does this pay you much? Hoping, because I'd just like to know what it paid. And he said, it doesn't pay an awful lot, but he said, it's worthwhile. He said, I only work there 4 days. And he said, I start at 9 and I usually end up at 1. $40. That's what the man was getting. So I started my sale, and by now I have about 800 or 1,000 people in the auditorium, and he is seated on an aisle seat. And I look the crowd over, and naturally there are some youngsters, some teenagers, but the solid group of people there were all on the wrong side of 40. And I'm going to make this guy feel great tonight. Because I know that when I mention that name, I mean here, I know the name. Everybody out there except the little kids that are tripping along the aisles don't know the name. So this is maybe about an hour and a half later, and he has a shopping bag full of goodies, the fruitcake and the socks and whatever I was pitching that night. And he had a young lady with him, and he was just ready to leave. And I said, could you wait one moment, please? And you could just see the expression on his face. He was thrilled because he figured I was going to introduce him. So I went through about a 6 or 7 minute pitch about a man that I have admired for years, and I know you know him. And he was one of the biggest record sellers for Victor at the time. It was a big, sensational name. And I said, he's going to be on the Ed Sullivan Show tomorrow. And I think we should give him a big hand. His name, Will Oakland. This is about the time. And I am so embarrassed and so broken up that I almost was going to choke up. And if any guy was going to cry, I was going to cry. Not him. And then some guy out in the back. Hey, John, how about those other fruitcakes and the salamis tonight? Let's get the sale going. And this guy had to clear out of the place. With no more than 8 or 10 people applauding, and all they were doing was applauding as a courtesy to me because I said to applaud. This is why so many times when I heard about your series, I think first it was in the New York Times, if I'm not mistaken.
I wrote an article about the Sunday Times, yeah.
And I have often wondered what happens to a person, and really not so much what has happened to them during the years, if they've sort of gotten out of the limelight, but I'm really interested also what their feelings are, how they're taking it, what it's like. I had an experience myself yesterday that kind of jarred me. I have, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 watches, like I guess we all have, you know, and you there's something new. The other one kept his good time, but you wanted to buy it. Well, I have a chronograph, and I was looking through this box where I have cufflinks and the different knickknacks that we've all acquired through the years, and I saw this chronograph, and it's a watch that I never liked the band. I wanted to get a leather band instead of a stretch band for it. And for some reason, I'll bet I didn't wear that watch over 5 times. And it's brand new, naturally. So I took the watch, and I sent it over to a jeweler. It's a watch that tells you the moon phases, the day, when you should gargle your throat, how not to get an ingrown toenail, just about everything. You know, you got levers on the side, and you press this, that happens, and it times, and all sorts of things. So there's a very, very fine watchman over in 47th Street. So I figured I haven't worn it this long. I don't know when I'm going to wear it again either, Richard, but I sent it over to him. I said, do me a favor, clean it, because I wanted it in perfect shape for what I don't know. Maybe I want it to be put in my box when they bury me. And I didn't look at the back or anything. And so the watch came back yesterday, you know, presumably been taken apart and cleaned and all the little gimmicks are working and all. And it's reset to Monday, September 11th and, you know, the right time and all. And I happened to turn the back. And I read and I forgot. And this was presented to Long John, the Gab and Gavel Man, which was what the news had called the thing when we had it out there. The New York Daily News gave us that title. And there's a couple of other things in the back of the watch. And then the date. It was December 1950. And all of a sudden, I was very jarred because I realized that 17 years, a big hunk of time, a kid could be 17 today. You know, any number of things. Here's a whole hunk of time, which it just tells me in the back that I had completely forgotten about. And at the time, this was a very successful business. I'm talking in a financial sense. And I wonder what it's like for these people who have been up like a Harry Richman. Even Alina Basquet. Lena, when she was on, I was amazed to hear that her sister was Marge...
Marge Champion.
Champion.
Half-sister, actually. But everyone is surprised. Yeah.
And, of course, I was also equally as amazed to find that Marge Champion was the second wife of Alexander King.
She was also the model for Snow White.
That's right. And all these things happen, and yet, somehow... I don't mean that in her case or Lena's case, but somehow these people just fade away and we never know what they're thinking about. Not their everyday thoughts about whether they should have sliced bananas on the cereal or not. Now, do you really get into that too?
Yeah, I think I do, but I don't, not on the program usually. Actually, I get a much better interview as soon as we stop recording, you know.
Why?
When we go up, I don't know. By then it's over, and they start talking, you know, and then you can't turn it on again. We'll go out to lunch or have a drink, particularly if it's done in their home. They tell me much more interesting stories. Usually 2 or 3 weeks later, I'll tell something much more interesting on another program that they had told me privately. But as far as how they have adjusted, each one seems to have a different story. I couldn't generalize about it, but if there were any way of doing it, I would say that the mind, it would seem, the human mind has a marvelous facility for rationalizing what has happened to one in one's life. Many of them have said to me, I wouldn't work again for all the money in the world, you know. Why, show business is nothing anymore, and I save
nothing
my money.
Nothing like when I was in it.
No, it's not. There's no show business anymore, you know. It's not like that at all. I wouldn't be in it for any... And others will say, well, I work when I want to. When I want to work, I pick up the phone, I call my man at the Morris Agency, and he gets me a booking. And, of course, he does at the Westbury Music Fair or something, you know. Quite a few of them... Particularly people around New York will say to me, well, why did you put so-and-so in the book? Because he's active. Well, if you live here, you see Lanny Ross, he is active. Yeah, you know, he does a summer stock, he plays in Miami in the winter, but if you live in Topeka, Kansas, you have no idea what Lanny Ross is doing. And he's, you know, well aware of that. It doesn't embarrass him at all. Jessica Dragonette said to me, I have never given up my singing career. I don't know why you would even approach me about a thing like this. Well, now, maybe she sings in the bathtub, because I haven't heard of Jessica Dragonette having any professional
engagements. Well, she did a book
in 20 years.
On voice lately.
Yes, she
voice
did.
Culture.
She was
I
on
think.
The program, too, yeah. Yes. Your Voice and You.
Well, do some people resent call on your part? In other words, if I call them, they may not resent it, but when you call them, it means that there has been?
I've had one who became very angry with me about it. And he said, I called him up. I'd written to his agent. I'll tell you who it is. It's a man named Larry Adler.
Yeah, I worked
and,
with Larry Adler.
He was living in London, so I wrote him a letter, and I said, if you ever come to New York, and also I'm doing a book and so forth. Now, I must say, I did not mention the title, because it is not very becoming, you know, but if anyone asks me, I tell them. It's not a secret about it. So about a week later, I got a call saying, this is Larry Adler's press agent, and he's in town. He's playing the Village Gate, and he'd love to do your program. What time can I send him up? So we made an appointment, and he came up. He sat down in the studio, and he said, I talked to a fan of yours the other day, and he told me who it was. It was a movie producer who I didn't know personally. He said, but he listens to your program all the time. He said, you have a program called Whatever Became Up? I said, yes, I have. He said, well, he warned me not to appear in anything that sounded like that, you know, with a... And I looked at him, oh, what do you say? And I said, oh, well, you ready to be recorded? And he said, yes. So we went into the interview. He gave me an excellent interview. And I opened by saying what inspired me to write to him was I had a letter from a 15-year-old boy who had seen a Busby Berkeley picture called The Singing Marine with Dick Powell.
Mm-hmm.
And it opened with a musical solo on the organ, or the mouth organ, by Larry Adler and what happened to this great musician. So we finished the interview, and he asked me if I could, he could use the phone in the office, and I think we had a drink or something. We talked for quite a long time. We got on very well, and he told me to come down and see him at the gate, which I didn't do, but I meant to. And when our folio comes out, we have a program folio, I send it to him at his London address, and about 2 weeks later, I got a letter from his secretary or assistant or something saying, how could you have done this to Larry Adler? You have deceived him. This is a dreadful thing you've done. You've made him a laughing stock in his, in the show business by putting him on a show like this. So I wrote back and said, in case this is some secretary who had one too many, you know, I don't want to answer the way I feel. So please initial this letter and send it back to me if this is correct, Mr. Adler. So he sent it back, initialed, and said, yes, I do feel like this. So I wrote back and I said, well, if someone came to you and said, I heard you are a marvelous musician and I want you to play tonight, just don't play that damn mouth organ. Now, what would you say? You know, people say crazy things to me all the time.
That's a funny line.
Yeah. I said, what did you think it was?
You know, I, in a way, I can understand. I think that if we both did the same interview, and I think that I would get in even possibly deeper than you because of the length of time I have, and he possibly wouldn't be half as offended because the title of the show doesn't say anything.
Yeah. And who has a better excuse for having been out of the limelight than Larry Adler, who's blacklisted?
Okay.
The best
yeah.
excuse in the world.
Okay. I think maybe that's what why it makes him so sensitive. He's
no,
he always has
I never thought of it though, but until whatever became of.
Well, I know he was in England.
No, I know when he was here, and I know because
people
they called
the
me and they wanted
know,
me to
sure.
put him on when he was at the
Village Gate.
The Village Gate. And I happen to have great admiration for the man. I think he's a very, very fine musician, and I enjoy his work. And I was really interested and thought about, but I must admit that the title can throw you. I don't know
well,
whether I would feel, I'd never thought about it, if Richard invited me to be on, I possibly would think too, say, well, what happened? Am I through?
But you don't qualify. I mean, you're very much in the picture. But look at it this way. I get people calling me all the time and saying, I have so-and-so. She works as a stenographer in my office, and this is her name, and this is what she did. And it's embarrassing because they have not had a big enough name. They appeared in one picture or made a one Broadway appearance. But the title of the program is Whatever Became of dot, 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 and then their name. And if that name doesn't register, no one's going to tune in. You know, whatever became of John Doe, if they don't, they've never heard of him. In order to have been a has-been, which is a very unkind word, but it's the only way to put it, you have to have been a name.
Yeah, you have people calling up to get on the show.
You must be, yes. You know, and
who never made it.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, well, sure. And
you write a book called...
I had a letter to...
Whatever happened to people who never made it?
Sure.
Then you leave your name. We're writing a book called Whatever Happened to People Who Never Made It?
Well,
I put you in there.
Kind about it, but I had a letter quite recently, and I would say this on the air because she can't hear it, but a neighbor had written and said, this lady is coming to New York. She lives in Silver Springs, Colorado, and I know you'd like to interview her after reading your book because she wrote the lyrics to Springtime in the Rockies.
I was going to ask you whatever became of Silver Springs.
You probably always wondered about her.
Whatever became of Silver Springs.
I want to do that myself, that one. Well,
I'll give her a lot.
I'll have first and last.
Well, listen, John, you may make the next book if they keep knocking the antenna down.
That's right.
Right?
I don't know. Well, BAI had trouble, too.
Listen, you tune into your news tonight.
Again,
you had a fire.
Yes, that's right.
A fire?
Yeah, I was going to take a nap before I get on this show, and I got in bed and the phone rang and they said, come over immediately. We're on fire. Yeah. They started a fire in the basement.
Trouble with the...
tonight at 8 o'clock.
With the crystal?
NBC
tonight.
Had a big thing on it tonight.
Tonight at 8 o'clock. I know, I called them.
The building down on 37th or 38th?
39th Street. 39th. That's right. Whole basement burned out. Two fire trucks, police all over the place.
Boy, that must be hanky-panky.
Oh, of course it ought
to be.
Couldn't hit it. Some and with all the threats.
Couldn't miss. No, we had bomb threats today, too, on the phone.
Well, you read the whole story.
Yes, did the police finally, they asked the police to get over there and say, hey, look, you know, help us out, the BAI said. And the police, did they come yet?
Oh, yes.
Oh, they're there now.
Yes.
Oh, good. Well,
yeah.
Oh, they were there originally, too, when the tragedy occurred at the transmitter. Famous personalities of yesteryear. There are many photographs, excellent illustrations, and We even have a picture of Atlas here. Did you actually interview him?
And I've spoken to him on the phone. He's here and there. You know, he travels around a lot. No, I haven't.
When I say Atlas for our listeners, they may
he stays off the beaches.
Yeah, he's the one that used to have the ad. You know, don't be the thin, scrawny guy.
The 90-pound weakling.
Sand in your eyes.
You think about the 90-pound weakling.
Yeah. 90,
I was once a 90-pound weakling.
That's right.
And taking the dynamic...
No one has ever seen him.
Come on. Now, don't give me that.
You've never seen him?
Oh,
not in person.
I have.
He's at the athletic club.
Yeah, sure.
This man did it without any equipment whatsoever. It's dynamic tension that he used.
Really,
and in fact, I know two fellas. One fella who died about a year ago, and the other fella is Roy Mills, and he's with Sportswear. It's a big firm that manufactures shirts and things like that. They're over on West 34th Street. And Roy Mills, I haven't seen him in about 3 or 4 years, so I don't know. Maybe he has been laying down on the job, but otherwise, he is one of the best-built men that I have ever in my life seen. And he was a scrawny guy, and he and his brother sprung for the course about 30 years ago.
It works.
Yeah, it really works. I'm not kidding you. This course really works, and I'm not selling it. And I don't know if Atlas even has any piece of the action anymore.
Oh, yes, he still does.
He does?
Yeah.
We have Roy Schatt with us, old but still scrawny and lovely. And we
have Roy Schatt's camera with us.
That's right. We have
with the lens cover on.
What is your name again, Crystal?
Crystal, Danny Crystal.
Danny Crystal. And the definer. What was your name?
Charles Atlas.
Oh, Charles Atlas. There he is, Charles Atlas.
But Paul, and I'm still young enough not to remember about a third of the names and the contents of this book. And
I'm happy
about that.
Robert Frankel is with us, the definer. You had some questions.
Yes. Richard, you wanted to be called Richard.
Please, yes.
And please call me Roy, and let's get cracking, as they say. Father Coughlin.
Oh, I was hoping you'd ask about him. You know, I make a bet with myself before I do all of these programs. If you're going to ask about one or three people, and he's one,
well,
always
he's got to be talked
up.
About because he, I mean, when you talk about people like McCarthy, and Huey Long, the over the years, this guy's really got to be talked about. And you've got a picture of him when he was at the crest.
Right.
You got him today now in retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was one of the most hateful people in the sense of Jew baiting, et cetera. Did you meet him?
Oh, yes. I'm from Detroit. I've served mass for him. So I can tell you quite a bit about Father Coughlin.
Well, let's go, pal. I'd like to know. Yes.
I've heard him speak many times. As I indicate, I think, in the book, he was not really silenced by Rome in that he was taken off the air. But he continued speaking from the pulpit. I have heard outrageous sermons by him as late as 1950, which is when I left Detroit. And in 64, 65, there were a number of complaints registered with the Archdiocese of Detroit about his haranguing the high school kids over the PA system from his office.
You use the word haranguing. What did he say, actually, in his harangue?
Well, I don't know. He was promoting right-wing politics. He supported Goldwater.
Yes, he did.
Very strongly in 1964. He's retired now, but I was in Detroit in February to do radio and TV to plug the book, and I thought, well, I'll go out and take a look at the Shrine of the Little Flower. Because people thought he left there, you see. He continued as pastor until a year and a half ago, and now he's still Pastor Emeritus. I didn't know that at the time, or I'd put that in the book. But there's a big brass plate, Pastor Emeritus, and when he's in town, which he is in the summer, he still celebrates Mass every morning. During the winter, he has a little house outside of Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah.
And he does quite a bit of traveling.
What about his followers? Does he still have followers?
Well, he keeps in touch with some because a couple I know, and they always send me his letters, after they've received them. I'm sure he doesn't know that, or he would stop corresponding with them. And he still feels very, very strongly about political things.
There are people today who are extremely passionate about Joe McCarthy. They talk about him like the great, great McCarthy. Those of us who were not for McCarthy are just the other way. Now, are there any amongst his followers, the passionate ones who loved what he did? And
oh, yes. I tried to do a program last fall. There was a man, there's no need to mention names, I think, because he's still here and he's in this vicinity, called the Cockburn of the East.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember him?
I don't know his name, no.
Well, he was a New York archdiocese priest, mm-hmm. and he still is, although he is not allowed to speak. He has a parish out here in Queens. Mm-hmm. He's still around. He still feels the same way. He would not allow me to interview him. I talked with him on the phone. He said no, he would not go on the air. He was under the authority, I suppose, of Cardinal Spellman, and he was not allowed to do any more speaking. But he was Cochran's key man on the East Coast. And when Father Cochran came here and addressed his followers at Madison Square Garden and caused a tremendous furor, he was introduced by this man, a Roman Catholic priest who was called the Cochran of the East.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who's from this area and remembers it, I'm sure remembers him.
Yes.
A lot of his followers were around. Yes, I was in touch with him because one would put me in touch with the other, but none would go on the air. Not one would go on the air.
Now, this is my point I'd like to follow up with. The Birchites, who are the right-wingers, and there are other right-wingers, you can go as far as you like these days, what do they mention? I don't know this. I'm asking the question, and perhaps you know him, perhaps you don't. Do they talk about Cogwin as one of the beginners? Nothing like that?
No, they don't. I know a number of people in the John Birch Society. Some I like very much, you know, mm-hmm. personally, and they refuse to talk about Father Coughlin. They refuse to talk about Senator Gerald P. Nye or Gerald L. K. Smith, yes. both of whom are in the book, or any of those of that era. I think you'd find the same thing with William Buckley, who's a spokesman for the right wing. He doesn't discuss them anymore. He treats them, I don't know about the Birch Society, sort of his camp. He makes a joke about it. And he
yes.
said, well, that was a long time ago, and we're discussing issues now. And he has a point. For this reason, you say right wing. I don't really know if Father Cochran falls into right wing. Now, he certainly baited Jews, but was he right wing? Because his platform was very socialistic. If you read the platform of the Union Party in 1936, which he ran, Lemke, remember,
yes,
Father Cochran
right.
supported Lemke in order to split the Democratic ticket. He and Dr. Francis E. Townsend, who is dead, I've interviewed him, but he's dead, and Gerald L. K. Smith, who I've interviewed and who's also in the book. Those three, they had the Long people, the Huey Long, which Gerald L. K. Smith took over when Long died, the Father Cochran movement, and Francis Townsend's Townsend plan. They all supported Lemke and ran him. Well, I've got a book that tells the platform of all the parties for all years. And it's a very, very liberal platform.
And you say that he was a liberal man?
Well, if you speak of domestic issues, oh, yeah, he wanted unemployment insurance, hike Social Security. It wasn't
But an enough. Exaggerated sort of unemployment insurance in that it wasn't it. I believe it was exaggerated, or don't you think
what
so?
What do you mean by exaggerated?
Well, I mean, there is the old every man a king thing, which was the slogan for Huey Long, which was certainly a slogan for everybody being happy and everybody sharing
the
wealth.
Redistribute the wealth.
Yes,
another.
And this too is now I call that way out distribution as an idea.
Well, now, one of Coughlin's famous slogans was a living wage for the working man.
Well, therefore, it would seem that as you a living wage doesn't sound like far out to me.
In Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
No. That was one of the reasons, because he was actually considered to be a liberal.
I didn't know
yes,
that.
Yes, he was on domestic issues, mm-hmm. yeah.
John, the thing, the guy that really excites me more than him, though, is the great hero who also was a Jew baiter, and that was Lindbergh.
Well, I discussed,
this
I've never interviewed
shocker.
Lindbergh, I guess no one has.
Well, you have him in the book.
30 years,
yes. Yeah.
I did the best I could. It's pretty hard digging up material on him. But I spent an evening with Senator Nye, Gerald P. Nye, about 2 months ago in Washington, D.C. And I said, you know, you're the only man I've ever met who really knew Lindbergh well.
Mm.
Would you tell me something about him? And he said, well, he told me a few things on the air. But the other things, he said, I'll tell you, you know, another time. So he was driving me back. He lives in Maryland. He was driving me back to Washington in my hotel. And I said, well, what was he like? And he said, well, he was like what he's like now. I said, you still see him? And he said, yes. And I said, well, tell me about him. He said, well, people say he's very bitter. He said, he doesn't seem to me bitter at all. And I said, well, he makes no public appearances. He said, well, he's always hated publicity, always loathed it. He just felt it was his duty during the 30s to come out for isolationism for America and to keep America out of war because he thought Roosevelt was you know, steering this country into national disaster. But I said, he's not bitter. He said, no, he's not bitter at all. You know, he fought in World War II, which, of course, he did. I say that in the book, although it was sort of, I guess he was the only one who fought under the counter, because he really wasn't a member of the armed forces, and yet he flew a number of dangerous flights during in the Pacific.
Yes, but his pro-Hitler, not pro-Germany would be a better way of saying that, I think. Speeches were really something to be considered at that time. He did come back, and he did say, he was pro-German, actually, in his speeches.
Well, I'm not going to argue with you, because I'm not that familiar with it, but I know he came back and said, Germany is arming to the teeth. And there's going to be a terrible commotion here. And Roosevelt, I know, was very annoyed that he said that.
But he also said, let's
keep out of it.
They didn't
want any boats being rocked at that time.
He did say, let's keep out of it,
didn't he? Oh, yes, he did, yeah. But does that mean pro-German? I'm asking you.
Well, you're giving one speech, but there were others that the reason...
Well, you say that Roosevelt was... and that there's been some indication, according to people on the air here, and I'm not an expert on Roosevelt or anything else for that matter, but didn't he do some things that some people might consider to be anti-Semitic?
I never heard of any.
No?
No.
You ever hear the deal that they tried to make to bring people out of Russia?
Out of Israel?
Germany? No. And that there was a boatload of people of the Jewish faith, I forget how many, and they were never able to land on these shores?
I heard something about that. Yes, I heard people writing about it. I don't know how true that is, though.
Well, in other words, because you don't like to believe it's
probably
true.
Probably that's
so that
true.
So you're going to brush that one off, but
you're willing to believe it because it's the other way then, John.
No, don't trick me because you're not that good. You're a very good photographer, but you're not going to match wits with me on that because I listen to you. You say about Father Coughlin, I did not care for this man.
Well, we agree there.
But the fact is that if you study, and I think that Richard is very, very right, basically what he was saying was what Al Lotman and any of the other so-called liberals on the show constantly say night after night, except they are not anti-Semitic. That is the line. He was not. He couldn't even be a member of the Birches. I don't think he'd ever want to be. He couldn't be a member, do you think?
I'm sure they wouldn't allow him in. No. Well, not unless he's changed his point of view.
Changed, yes.
But we're getting away from Roosevelt, and there are stories about Roosevelt and many that have been written by people who may very well be right. I don't know whether they're right or wrong. I'm not attempting to match wits with you, John. I'm just wondering about these stories, some of which were made up out of whole cloth and have never been proved. Some of which have, however.
Well,
did you ever?
No, I don't know the ones that have or haven't. I do not know. But the fact is that you sat here in front of this microphone for the last 10, 15 minutes talking about Coughlin, who is still alive, and the material is available to read, which it isn't a matter of proving or disproving. You right away said, well, of course, his idea of money for everyone or social security for
everyone. It's
kind of far out. Why do you
say
it was far out? I think that social security is far out the way it is right
today.
But
the question was it far out? Not it is far out.
In other words, you did not make a statement.
I did not make a statement.
I didn't hear your punctuation.
There we are.
I didn't hear your punctuation.
All right. But he is a Jew-baiter, Coughlin is, and I think that's
right.
Reprehensible.
Right.
And he also was against the Negro, and I felt that was reprehensible. Now, do you agree with that?
I frankly don't remember any statements about the Negro.
I didn't even think he knew that there were Negroes around.
That's very funny.
There weren't around Royal Oak. I don't think there are yet.
I think that his hang-up, unfortunately, was he was a Jew-hater.
He sure was.
Yeah. But I don't think that he ever got involved. And I don't mean that he was defending the Negroes. I don't think this was not one of his problems.
It may not have been. I don't know too much about that.
I heard anything about Negroes.
That's the point, you see. I thought perhaps you had enough information to tell me about that, you see.
I suppose that if he were in action today, he might even be anti-Negro. You know,
I wouldn't guess that way at all. He might be.
Well, I would say that if he was... if he happened to be anti-Jewish, he
would
be...
It would seem it would follow.
He would go right along the whole way. Mr. Crystal.
Wake up.
Hello, yes. Yes. Well, Roy, you just did my first half hour. Well, thank you.
Did you have Cogburn as your first?
One of the less controversial people in the book, Roy. I knew you'd open with that name. Oh, show off. Well, I know one of the people in your book listens to the show, Ella Logan. She listens to this show quite a lot. As a matter of fact, many times that I've been on the show, John will bear this out. I just mentioned Ella Logan, John, as an old listener to this show, and Ella is in the book. And
she certainly is not whatever became of. Clearly.
No.
Are you serious?
Well.
Oh, really?
It's just that
she is a current performer.
Ella.
Where? Well, I'd love to catch the act.
I don't know where every act is playing. If I said to you, where is Irving Aronson and his Commanders playing? You don't know who
recently she the last time she was on Broadway is in an ill-fated show, of course.
Well, she wasn't on Broadway.
Well, actually, she wasn't. She left.
Right.
Because, as you haven't said in your book, she has a good sense to cancel, step out of the production.
Walter Kerr wrote that wonderful critique. Yeah, she'll be immortal for that, if something else.
Closed after one performance, so she must... Yeah. Not only be a good performer, but she must have a wonderful sense of ESP.
Incidentally, someone told me this summer they were reviving that show.
Kelly?
Yeah.
For 20 minutes.
Who told me that was...
They have a... What is this? Some theater that has one night they want to fill in?
No. It was someone in the business who told me they invested quite a bit of money and they were going to try to bring it back.
I think they're beating a dead horse. I'm more interested in... Richard, in your book, where it concerns show personalities.
Well, I'm doing
another
one. Most of them will be show personalities.
Yeah,
we found that to be
Veronica Lake and Phil Spitali. Some of the people I kind of knew what had happened to them, although it's always very interesting to read that Judy Canover is living out on the coast and. The picture of her with Ben Blue, but taken in 1937, and one of her down here at the on the next page. And you say she makes an occasional rodeo appearance. She doesn't work. She doesn't have to work anymore, and that's always good to hear. And you have some controversial theatrical figures, Ann Revere, who was cited by
House Un-American Activities Committee.
Got herself on the blacklist. And
also Gail Sundergaard.
Gail Sundergaard, Larry Parks.
Right.
And you have a picture of an old friend of mine, Larry Crabb, Buster Crabb.
Yeah, very nice man.
Who is a swimming instructor.
He's also a stockbroker right here in New York City.
Yes, he's given my brother
Doesn't
a couple
he look
of
great?
Very good tips. Yo, fantastic.
Really looks amazing.
You know, when you sit next to Buster Crabb, when you get very close to him, even then, you know, even though you can see the lines in his face, he doesn't look his age, which, I better not say. I'm sure. Although he did mention it on The Tonight Show a few months ago, a month or so ago. I just in his 60s. But when he turns around and walks away from you, he looks like a 30-year-old guy. Fantastic shape. And there's another old-timer in the book that I work with on his first nightclub engagement when I was doing an act, and that's Freddie Bartholomew. And I don't know whether he's listening or not, but he did the worst act in the world. It was embarrassing. And he's successful now in other fields, but I worked twice with him, as a matter of fact. Once, I worked with Bela Lugosi once at a place called the Victory Theater in Bayonne. It was the first vaudeville date I ever played. I was breaking in an act that was written for me by Jack Barnett, who then went on to write for the Jimmy Durante. I worked with Freddie Bartholomew in that same theater, and then we played a place called the Monte Carlo in Pittsburgh, and he was on the show, and it was really, I can remember.
About what year was this?
This was, I don't know. Let's see, 54, something like that, I think.
Well, he's done all right. Did you know he was the vice president of...
Yeah, well, I know that he had, got, he first he went into radio, I believe. He was.
I think television here, one of the local, he was
PIX,
the host, I think, at the afternoon
that's
movie.
Fine. I'm glad, you know, because he certainly didn't belong in nightclubs. That wasn't his forte. And
he's
he was, you
well.
Know, the adorable little English boy in films, sitting on Spencer Tracy's knee.
You know, he really was good, though. When you look at the old movies,
yes.
I do a
yes.
lot. You know, some of them don't stand up, but I saw him in Captain's Courageous.
His performances were good.
Anna Karenina, and he really was a fine little actor. Some
yes.
of them were embarrassing, you know. We thought
yes.
were cute at the time. They really weren't.
Well, there's Dickie Moore.
Yeah. Well, Dickie isn't in the book, but I know him. He's been on
yeah.
my program a couple of times,
uh-huh.
and
uh-huh.
he's done very well. He has a public relations firm.
Yeah.
I
always liked him.
Here in New York. He's a very nice man.
Yeah.
Yeah, very
and so from just looking at these pictures like Louise Reiner, who is really a freak in our business, if you can call the motion picture business part of our business, who won an Academy Award, too, wasn't it?
The
only woman,
only woman.
To win
2 years,
in a row and go down the drain, become an unknown after winning 2 Academy Awards.
Yeah.
And I think she was probably one of the reasons that a lot of credence was given to that almost the same kind of feeling. If you get your picture on the cover of Time magazine, it's a jinx. You win the Academy Award.
It sure has been for her.
Shortly afterwards, you know, nobody knows you, but can you imagine winning the Academy Award 2 years in a row, and they were very good films.
Not for supporting roles,
no,
rather.
As
the
female star,
actress.
It was in The Great Sick Field and then in The Good Earth. Right?
And she was practically an unknown when it
That's
happened.
That's right, and she was not only an unknown, but she was a foreigner who had an accent, and they had to find roles to fit her.
Yeah.
And there she was.
Well, I think that was one of the problems. You know,
yeah.
she was hard to cast.
And she lives now, what, in England?
She lives in London. She's married to a publisher.
It's a wonderful.
Incidentally, about Freddie Bartholomew, I found this out a couple of months ago. He lives in a little town, I can't think of the name of it, right over the bridge here in New Jersey. I beg your pardon?
In New Jersey.
Yeah, in New Jersey. And I went over there to do an interview with a silent star named Priscilla Dean, who was in a picture called Under Two Flags.
No, I was thinking of Priscilla Lane.
Now, I'm
Priscilla
going to tell you about Priscilla Lane, if you like.
Yeah.
No, Priscilla Dean was a big silent star, early silent, about 1919, 1920, 1921. And I said, what do you do over here? You know, and she said, well, one of the things I do is I'm on the volunteer ambulance corps. And Freddie Bartholomew is on the same shift with me. In a little town, they volunteer for ambulances.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. You have a wonderful picture of Norma Shearer in your book.
Yeah, she's coming to town, I think, next week.
Yes.
Some big ski affair at the... You're in town.
Gentlemen, let me interrupt here for just people that you find refuse you. You did mention about the harmonica Larry Adler, who was a little unhappy. He didn't refuse you. But.
Yes. Well, no. Very few people refuse the radio program because there they can't be seen, you see. The main objection is women, they don't resent the title, particularly silent stars or early talkie stars, but they're out of the public eye and they do not want to give up that now picture. You know, of how they look now.
Yeah.
And some of them, they'll admit it. They'll say, well, I'd love to be in your book. You know, it's a nice idea, and I think you've treated the other people well because I'm doing another volume now. And I'm getting this from quite a few, but I don't know. You know, they look at how I looked, and then they look at how I look now, and it's so depressing. And, of course, it isn't because most of them really look very well.
Yeah, they
do.
They
really
kind
look
of, they
amazing.
Age well. They're charming-looking people.
You don't look too bad, Danny.
Yes, John, when I was in silent films, I didn't look a heck of a lot different than I look now. And then when I went into talkies, you remember that back in the early
30s. Well, I didn't know you at the time,
but
I remember some of the pictures.
Charlie Bird and Mary Krell, who you mentioned earlier, and we were in a picture called Under Six Flags. It was a larger picture than Under Two Flags, and it was the picture that brought me into prominence in talking pictures, and from there on, my career.
You had to ask him that question, John, didn't you?
Mediatric flop.
Look at this.
No, as a matter of fact, I like the idea, Richard, of you, even including yourself, then and now in the back.
That's very good,
there's a picture of you now, and there's a picture of you as a baby, which I think
funny because
carrying
my
a little
publisher didn't
far,
think it was a bit funny.
Really?
My publisher, didn't think the book was interesting either.
Really?
They turned it down once before.
No.
A year later, they took it and went to 9 different publishers. But when I said, let's put it on the back, you know, to show that we're not taking this all that seriously.
Yeah.
It's kind of a campy book. And they said, oh, no, what do you mean? Who would want to see you as a baby? You know?
Do they have a lot of wood paneling in their office?
Oh, no, no.
No, they're like old
very stodgy.
It'll never
publisher.
Sell,
they're successful.
Oh, Crown is very successful. Yeah. One of the most successful publishers around, yes. Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to Volume 2 because I...
You're going
to
be in it?
I would like to be
Dinky
in it.
Dinky Dean. A lot of people ask about Dinky Dean.
I have some very good photos of me.
Wasn't he Dinky Dean?
Yes.
He wasn't Baby Peggy because she's in the book.
Yeah, Baby Peggy.
He was Kippy.
That's hard to say three times fast.
Hesse.
Peggy. Peggy. Yeah. Baby Peggy. What?
Kippy Hessick.
I was Kippy.
You know
Hesse.
Our director?
Soupy Sales.
When our director, Cliff Hesse, was a boy, and when he was first in the theater, he was called Kippy Hesse. And many people out in Brooklyn
they
remember
Kippy,
Kippy Hesse.
But he gave a lot of MCs a hard time. Here he is, Kippy Hesse.
Get him off, he's drunk.
No, that really is the name, Kippy Hesse. Get him off.
There's a restaurant on 52nd Street.
There he is now, Kippy Hesse.
Kippy's, yeah.
Kippy's, yeah.
Very successful. Yeah. You had some questions.
Yeah, seriously. I certainly hope so. Yes.
On a more serious...
Getting cobwebs around your microphone there.
If I could get over to it, I'd... You have 100 names here, and it seems you have so much variety. Sports, show business, they're laughing at me. I'm just trying to ask you a serious question. And how did you go about choosing? And I'm sure there's so many more that whatever became would apply to whatever became of. Not to exclude Danny Crystal, of course.
Right. Next book.
How did you go about choosing these names?
Well, I tried to balance it as well as I could with sports people and politicians and theatrical people and radio people and then kind of freak personalities like Elaine Berry Barrymore or the first Miss America, you know, which really doesn't fit into either category. But the next volume, which will be Volume 2, whatever became of Volume 2, and that'll be out in the spring, it'll be nearly all theatrical personalities because I found... both in the mail that we've got, and also when I do these radio programs where they have call-in, you know, they never ask me about politicians.
Yeah,
it's too bad.
Really
I think they're most interesting. They'll always, you know, ask about Kay Francis or, you know.
Yeah.
Which is
not going to be in your book next?
No, the reason I mentioned her is that people always ask about her. She, like Father Coughlin, was one of the most popular, and she did refuse. She lives here in New York. A lot of people ask me about
her. Why she refused?
Well, I don't know. Her lawyer said sorry, but she didn't want to have any publicity at all. And friends of mine have seen her on the street. She looks fine, but she will not give interviews. She will not sign an autograph. There are very few who will not sign an autograph. Catherine Hepburn's the only one I know. Mm. She just walks away. It's too bad because she's very well remembered. And
well, I'll never forget her.
Kay Francis,
marvelous. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even I can remember her. And as I said, there's only about a third of these names that I
very distinctive actress, you know, and made a lot of pictures, an awful lot, and a lot of money. So there's, I don't, you know, why would she be embarrassed about this? But she won't.
But continue.
Go ahead. Go ahead,
Richard, thank you. You have Beverly Adlin in here.
Yes, I've met her. She's very charming.
It wasn't too long ago, 1959, when she achieved her notoriety, or should I say fame? Notoriety. Now, here it is 8 years later, and now you're saying whatever became of it.
But she dropped from the public eye, didn't she?
Really?
You remembered it. Did you have any idea what she was doing?
Absolutely not.
No.
Absolutely.
And you were dying to know.
Oh, yes. I'm glad I found out here. And I won't tell so the readers can buy the book and find out what happened to Beverly.
Well, I'll tell you this much, though, lest we keep them hanging. I went to see her about a year and a half ago. She was playing a little nightclub over here in the East 50s, the Tiger Lily, a very chic little club. And it was her closing night, so she had nothing to plug, really, and everything to lose, an interview, you know, with a girl who's known for nothing except embarrassing things. So I didn't think she would give me an interview to begin with.
Don't you think we ought to name the man right now? So it may have, some of the people out there in radio land that don't know who we're talking about.
Beverly Adlin.
About why is she famous?
Oh,
there
must be teeny boppers who wouldn't remember.
Okay. I think there's some people out there who would like to know that.
So in other words, you have no time limit or the 8 years could be applied to one person and possibly 30 years to another. You have no... It just,
well, now about...
You can use a yardstick to measure a...
Now, about 2 years ago, close to 2 years ago, there was a murder, if you recall, a very famous murder. It was all over the papers for... now, what happened to the two defendants, the man and the woman? You know who I'm talking about? Candy Mosler.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
so
yeah.
How long do we have to wait before people would be curious? Because I'm dying to know now, and it hasn't even been 2 years. Have you any idea what they're doing?
Well,
they have all that lovely money.
I would
money.
Surmise, but right? I don't really know.
She hasn't married him, the nephew, who was 20-some years her junior.
Well, forgive me just a moment. Yesterday, picked up this woman who supposedly murdered her own daughter. And this was after 2 years, and I'm going right along with you that they... She has become now a bit of news, so there you are.
Yeah. Some drop out of sight overnight.
And so it became.
Well, this was an unsolved murder, and allegedly the Mosler murder case was solved, tried, convicted, acquitted, and it's supposed to be now a closed case, whereas the criminal
was still open because it's unsolved.
Criminal is open. But Mosler, well, no. That's right. The
no one was convicted.
That was a trial. That's the difference between.
Right.
That's right.
But I'm sure a lot of people, when I do Volume 3, right. I certainly will include her. I'll tell you who I'll have in Volume 2, Dave Beck.
Dave,
that's not
sure.
long ago.
No. Sure, the president of the team, the ex-president of the
right.
team. It seems that that's a very tough, that's a hot spot. It seems to go
funny,
from
I got
that,
a letter back from
that
right away
directly
said, yes,
into
be happy to cooperate. Now, that's the last
Dave
person
Beck
I think
did?
Would want to. Yes, he said he will send me a recent photograph and be happy to...
But to be interviewed?
Well, he's in Seattle. I don't know. If I go there, I imagine, because he wrote a very pleasant letter back and just said, send me your questions. I'm sending you under separate cover, a recent photograph. And he told me a little bit what he was doing. He was with the Union Pension and Welfare Fund, and he did quite well financially, before they got him. Mm. So I won't really have any testimonial dinners for him.
Richard, there's one person who... Sort of, I find, it'll probably possibly be in your next volume, I find sort of conspicuous by her absence. And she, you could say whatever became of her, but I think she's doing very, very well with television commercials, a former child star, and I'm sure we all know
yes.
her here. She's a lady plumber. She's,
she's qualified.
Hey,
no, but she's on.
Well,
no.
Jane Withers. Now, I don't think...
Yeah.
They know. I agree with you. I don't think they know her name.
I don't think the average.
Well,
do.
I do, but I don't
really?
Think most people do.
Jane Withers.
Right. Jane Withers is that lady.
But she looks exactly
that,
the same.
Yes,
I think.
Well,
she sounds
yeah.
the same.
Well, although she's not identified as Jane Withers, it isn't Jane Withers Plumber. It's just.
You may be right. It's just that.
Would you?
Just
do you have any?
That people know who she is.
Now, I'm sure there are others in show business who possibly. Qualify under the same sort of condition as
sure,
Jane
I think
Lizard.
Kenny Singleton does.
Well,
now, she's
now, I don't
very,
know what she's doing.
Very active. She's in town yeah. right now, I think.
She's, well, she's active
Agra.
In the union.
Agra,
but what is
yeah.
she doing professionally?
I don't think she is.
Well, that's
yeah,
what
she
she's
isn't.
Doing,
but she
I
qualifies.
Guess.
Yeah.
Well,
so people
you
in
mean
the business
if
the
person
know what she
is
does.
Still involved in show business professionally, you will not include them in the book. Is that it?
No, I wouldn't say that because sometimes, they work once or twice a year, as I say, like, Lanny mm-hmm. Ross. Arthur Tracy, the street singer, works. He didn't resent being in the book at all. He's been on my program several times, and because he knows people don't know what he's doing. He just played London, I guess, very successfully a few weeks ago, and he'll play any date, and he makes no bones about it. He would love to work, and yet the man has a lot of money.
Yeah, he doesn't need
But he really likes
well,
to work.
Yeah. He's been on with us, too.
Yeah, he's a nice man. Good
delightful
interview.
Delightful gentleman. Yes, it sounds like framed.
Very realistic,
Fabulous,
he says people don't remember him.
Yeah.
I think
he would be, a little more inclined to be realistic. There are some people who...
Oh, I think
it's easier with money,
goals,
I suppose,
yeah.
No, he was a big
name. Same as John Anthony.
You have him in your...
Right.
John
yeah.
Anthony.
Mm-hmm.
Richard, there are lots of things I could cover for in radio, especially. And there were many programs that I can recall as a child where I wouldn't know who the stars are. I could think of one like Vic and Sade, for example.
Well, I can tell you about
now,
Vic and Sade.
Would you include those in a subsequent book, possibly?
No, I agreed with the publisher not to use radio people unless they were famous as themselves.
I see.
For instance, I wouldn't use Helen Trent. Now, she's been the woman who was
right.
Julie Stevens, or Ann Elsner, who was a... Because
Stella
people
Dallas.
Didn't... Yeah, Stella Dallas.
How about Dick Comer?
He was Boston Blackie, I remember.
Well, no, but I mean to think of him in terms of Dorothy and Dick.
Oh. I would interview him on the radio program, but the book, Bean Pictorial, I don't think people would know what he looked like then, and they wouldn't be that curious about what he looked like now, would
he
they?
He was
radio?
A very famous musical comedy star. Very famous. And then in radio, of course, in radio they didn't see him as Boston Blackie. Yeah. And then for 18 consecutive years, the Dorothy and Dick Show, the morning show from 9 to 10. And today he is extremely successful with an art gallery.
And he had
Pastiche. What's
Pastiche is the name of it.
Yeah. And he just married a great designer.
What, a dress designer?
Yes. Very fine. Very funny.
Don't know.
There's a very famous MC in television today that if I say he played Superman many, many years ago on the radio. Would you
sure, Bud Collier. Yeah, he was on my program along with Lois Lane, the girl who played, Superman. No, I didn't use him in the book. There'll be a few more radio people in the next book. Minerva Pius, Mrs. Nussbaum, will be in it. Mm-hmm. And also Irene Wicker, the singing lady.
Singing lady. Oh, yeah.
Married to
Victor Hammer.
Yes.
Victor Hammer, yeah.
Well, do you have any intention of doing it, or did you have decide against doing a book with these radio people who weren't known, but were known as by the character they?
No, we decided against them because they weren't that well known by their name. Mm-hmm. Now I'll tell you, the back of the next book, rather than the the baby picture and one as I look now, we've done that and it was very funny. But the back of the next book on the jacket will be a picture of myself with Stella Dallas, Just Plain Bill, David Harum. We've got about 13 or 14 of them together. We're going to get together in a couple of weeks and photograph it up in After's office. All of the old soap opera people. Mm. Maybe Captain Video. I'll tell you, we'll be in the book of television personality, Buffalo Bob. He was on my show. Howdy Doody.
Howdy Doody.
Why not?
Buffalo Bob.
I was
Smith.
Too old for
one of the earliest and biggest TV stars.
Bob Smith is a very wealthy man. In fact, Dayton Allen worked with him for a long while. In fact, Dayton was in my office today. He comes in. He very kind. Dayton Allen does his typing in my office. Hi, Dayton. And he was with Howdy Doody for a long while. Then Bob Smith had some cardiovascular difficulty. And when he recuperated, he did a show for WOR from 1 to 5 in the afternoon from his home up in Scarsdale or something.
New Rochelle.
Right. And he plays many musical instruments. He plays tuba, plays xylophone,
that?
Piano.
Dayton Allen?
No, not Dayton Allen.
Bob Smith.
No, Dayton took piano for 4 weeks.
Yeah,
and
be careful if you're using your office. He'll take the typewriter, the desk, and that freak lamp you got down there.
Now, let me tell you, he studied for 4 or 5 weeks piano, and he had invested like $80 in the lessons, and he found he wasn't getting anywhere, so he wrote a book, How to Play Piano. This is no kidding. And he made over $60,000 off.
Change his name to Leroy, right? Change his name to Leroy.
This is square.
Remember
he really
that guy
did.
At the book?
Leroy made a lot of money. You remember
radio?
Leroy on radio? That was a big
and
name.
And then he played the piano and say, and you can play like this, and it was...
Ugh. John, do you
Bottoms.
Remember...
Excuse me.
Sorry.
Do you remember...
Sorry, Mr. You mentioned WOR. You remember a program many years ago, I think about 20 years ago, called Exploring the Unknown?
Yes.
Do you recall that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I remember the first time I ever went to a radio program, just to digress for a moment. I saw this. I went to this particular program, and the star of the show, I don't recall even what it was about, was William Prince.
Yeah.
Who at that time was doing very well on the stage. He was in films. He was quite a young actor, and I was very impressed. And I remember at the end of the show, I was in my early teens at the time, we all went back to get autographs. And I remember coming up to this star at that time, and waiting my turn, and I handed him my piece of paper and said, "Could I have your autograph, Mr. Prince?" He said, "Sure," and he was very friendly, asked me a few questions. I was very impressed by how nice he was, and, you know, gee, this is a big star, and he was so, and I never forgot it. Well, you mentioned about Will Oakland.
Mm.
Well, I don't think William Prince has yet faded into oblivion, but I'm
sure
he's
still a big name in the theater.
But I'm sure he's he's not as well known now as he was then. Well, a couple of years ago, I had occasion to walk in Central Park. And I'm sorry, I was just strolling there. It was daytime.
Oh, okay. All right.
It was a populated area. And I noticed this gentleman walking toward me, and I have a penchant for remembering a face. And as he, of course, he was considerably grayer, and he didn't quite have the bearing he had then. And sure enough, it was William Prince.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Mel Allen. It was Mel Allen, who looked a lot like William Prince.
Danny Crystal, but when I approached, as I got
and he didn't remember you.
Would you believe he didn't remember me?
Right.
Well, I approached him. I
would believe.
Aren't you William Prince? And he said, "Yes, I am." And he seemed sort of surprised that I recognized him. And I recalled
he had a chronograph watch on.
He had a chronograph.
It said to William Prince from the cast of Exploring the Unknown.
And I recall,
good luck in your future endeavors.
Danny,
you're walking in Central Park many years from now. And you won't remember
this
us.
This pink kid who was giving you a hard time. Anyway.
He's winning.
I'm still talking, though.
That's right. You are indeed.
Did you cut the thing? Am I still on?
Keep the tank rolling.
I don't care what. I'm going to keep talking.
I would do that if I were you. Don't let that Danny character.
And I came up to him and I said, "Aren't you William Prince?" And he said, "Yes." And I recall this incident about what happened 20 years ago. And I said, "Mr. Prince, I've never forgotten it." And he became sort of emotional about it.
Did a tear fall down his cheek?
Well, he was very appreciative of the fact that I remembered and the fact that I gave him that little recognition. And I think that meant quite a bit to him. And I sort of along the same line of this Will Oakland incident, only I was the only one there, and yeah. I gave him...
You almost don't have the block, anyone.
I
stepped on your lawn. I'm sorry, Dan.
The same thing has happened. I've met a lot of people in the park who I've seen, you know, through the years. A couple of nights ago, I was walking over Louise's. That's when I saw you, John, that night. What was it?
Yes.
A couple of nights back. Mm. And what's his name walked by me, the Star of Hawaii...
Julian
Max Van Sydow, and he didn't even say hello to me, you know. And I was going to say, "Max, you old devil, you
probably
hated you in Hawaii.
Yeah.
You set back the missionaries 30 years with your performance." But I figured I better not, because you know, one time he played God. You know, he could have struck me down there on the street, just put his fingers out and say, "Go, baby." So I figured I better not. You know, gotta. Sonia Heine, let's talk about her. There's a famous story about the guy who
you're
was...
You're jumping me, Danny. Don't
no, no, I just want to tell the story. The guy that used to stand in front of the Grauman's Chinese Theater on the preview nights, he had a microphone and called for the star's car, and it was his first night. He was he wanted to be an announcer. He went to that school that you have as a sponsor. And he was a nervous wreck that night, because it was his first night, and he called the cars, and you know, he'd say, James Stewart's car, you know, and they roll the car, the limousine up, and the star gets in. And he says, Clark Gable's car, Sonia Heine's Heine. Hi, Sonia Heine's car, you know, like panic. You know. I always want to see that story. But she's a very wealthy woman, isn't she?
Oh,
she's,
very.
You know, she has the Order of St. Olaf from the king, you know. She was awarded that, the Norwegian. She has a home in... Bel Air, California, and one in Norway.
Yeah, and a fortune in art.
And a fortune in art. I remember one of her last performances live. She played the Roxy, the old Roxy. She skated around, you know. And I was a nervous wreck because I was hoping she wouldn't trip. You know, whoops. But she had a lot of guys always skating close by her.
I think you were hoping she would
trip. Big production of
her.
She came down on a trapeze or something.
Did she do the hula number, famous hula number?
Yeah, the hula number.
I used to work for Ice Capades. You know, it was very funny.
Yeah,
for quite a while. Because their shows were much more lavishly produced than hers. Also, the Ice Follies. But they never did any more business, because she had that star quality, you know, and she had that great smile. And she isn't the most agreeable woman in the world, you know.
No, I understand.
But she really comes over. She can really make contact with an audience. John Harris, who I worked for, did everything to sell Donna Atwood. People still don't know who she is.
Yeah, amazing. guess there was room for one, Sonia. Just to think that in the movie world we had a dog, Rin Tin Tin was a star, you know, like, and we had an ice skater, Johnny Weissmuller, a swimmer who was in the book. You know, you don't find that today anymore.
Did you do, I don't remember, did you do...
Eleanor Holmes?
Yeah, Eleanor Holmes.
No, Volume 2, she'll be in.
I have an old friend of mine in your book, Bert Wheeler. You remember Bert,
Yes.
John?
Yes.
Very nice man and a very, very funny man.
I worked with him in one of his earlier nightclub appearances in a place called Dinty's Terrace Gardens outside of Albany, and he was a nervous wreck. You know, he hadn't played many nightclubs at the time, and he was doing that High Pockets thing she did with Hank Ladd and what he did with Tommy Hanlon, Jr., who subsequently has gone to Australia and done very well over there. He's a nice man.
Did he ever tell you any of the Frank Faye stories?
He's famous for the Frank Faye stories.
I love Frank Faye stories. Yeah. I know several myself. Amazing. You can't tell all of them on the...
It really tickled me in a way because I was nervous, the normal nervousness that one would get in a nightclub, especially in this nightclub, because it was the kind of club, if they didn't like you, they didn't cancel you, they rubbed you out. And
what do you mean by rubbing you out?
Well, it was like, you know, I always get the feeling the boys were floating around the place. Mm-hmm. But it subsequently burnt down. Another place that I worked at either was ripped down or burnt down. Theaters all over the country.
Did you ever work with Gene Austin?
No, I never did.
He's now there. It was a very big name as a singer.
Yeah, great.
No one asked me about him. I'm going to use him in the second book because he still has either number two or number three best-selling
all
record.
All-time best-selling record.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of the other fellow, though, who played guitar, who was so great. Played a very good guitar and sang as a soloist. What is his name? Nick Lucas.
Yeah. Boy, the soundproofing in this studio is great.
Oh, no, but they have an amplifier in there.
Take out the glass. I don't know what that's there for, anyway.
No, because we have a contract with a window washer.
Oh, I see.
And that's why we have to keep the glass in there.
You've got to do something with the chairs, too. It's just sort of Grandma Moses here with the creaking. And
I wonder if we could ask you to go out and have another cup of coffee, Dan.
Have the sandwiches get here yet, too?
Yeah, they're out there now, please.
Because I've already chewed through part of the book.
Yeah. Would you, please?
The sandwiches are... Got the cashmere sweater on. He's giving us a hard time tonight.
Would you mind? Please.
No, I'm going now.
Yeah, because I do want to take care of a little business here.
Right.
Two book titles, Whatever Became Of. Richard Lamparski is the author. And there's an introduction by Cleveland Amory. I found the book to be of great interest to me. I don't know, maybe I'm nostalgic. But to learn about such people as John L. Lewis and Red Grange. What was his number, 77?
Sunset Strip, you're thinking.
No, no. What was the famous number for Red Grange?
I think it was 77.
It was Plaza 372.
No, you're saying Murray Hill 4300.
Pennsylvania 65,000.
All right. You read about Sally Rand and John T. Scopes and Blanche Sweet and Carl Hubbell and Johnny Wrongway Corrigan and Gertrude Ederle. And so many of the people that we knew about, and you find out what they're doing today. I think that Richard deserves a lot of credit because the book is excellent, and I think Crown were very bright to publish it. The title of it again, Whatever Became Of, and we have these three gentlemen to interview Richard about. Rorschach.
The most important trial, I think, in years was the Scopes trial. It interested me anyway, and it interested, I think, most of America at the time. I think it was one of the most dramatic events. And Scopes himself was an idealist, I feel. At the beginning, he was just a plain guy, a teacher who wanted to tell what he felt, but after a while, he kept to it. And certainly, our friend... the great Darrell, Clarence Darrell, if the story is correct in Inherit the Wind, I get mixed up with reality and the play itself. It seems that Darrell eventually forced him to continue the trial. Did you talk to Scopes?
Yes, at length. He was in town, I'd say, about 7 or 8 months ago. and I talked with him. He told me quite a few things that are not in the book because he didn't answer my letter. I did the best I could, and I said to him, look at the book before we go on the air. You know, maybe you're mad at me. You don't want to do the program. And he read it, and he said, no, you've only one thing wrong. I think I called him a biology teacher, and he said, no, actually, I taught math. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was the other way around. But he said, other than that, it was completely accurate. He was sort of incidental to the trial, of course.
Yes.
You call it the Scopes trial, but an awful lot of people refer to it as the monkey trial.
They don't
even know who John Scopes was. They'd asked a number of people to be a defendant in this case because it was a trial case. It was something they had to drum up because they wanted to test the law of evolution, which is still on the books of Tennessee, incidentally.
Yes.
And they finally asked Scopes, and he was unmarried at the time, and a socialist and a very great admirer of Clarence Darrow, as any, I suppose any liberal was and is today. And he said, all right, he would do it, because it was quite an ordeal. And it turned out to be much more of an ordeal than he thought it was. It was a long trial, it was tough, and he is not a man who likes publicity. He doesn't today. As I say, he didn't answer my letter. He and Colonel Lindbergh are the only ones I know who have this policy. They don't answer any mail. And he said that his reason was the same reason that Lindbergh gives, is that if he answers one, he makes that letter, for one thing, very valuable. And if he answers one, he should answer all of them. How can you discriminate? Because an awful lot of people write to both of them, I guess, are students, and they're researching the Scopes trial or the Lindbergh years. And they really all should be answered, but they can't. So I don't know what Mr. Scopes said he did with his. Lindbergh gives his all to, I think it's Yale University. They put them in a vault, kept there in a collection. What did you ask me? Sorry, I got off of it.
No, well, the point is that it's such an important trial. I mean, there are still people who insist that evolution is, you know, for the birds. It's not to be studied. It's not really the way things should be.
Are there really?
There are. Oh, yes, there are people around. They certainly are.
I said, would you do it again? He said, I should. It's still on the books of Tennessee.
It's still on the books of Tennessee is your best answer, actually. And I saw it on TV a matter of a month ago. This guy's still yelling, making a great big speech in the Senate? Do they have a Senate or a House of Congress down in Tennessee? And actually saying it's the word of God who said, you know, that this could not be, that man does not come from the ape. And, of course, that's not what Darwin said at all. And they don't listen. These people just don't listen to what really has been said about evolution. And, of course, there are many mistakes we found out today in the Darwin theory. But basically, the most scientists believe in evolution. Quote, you know, the word evolution is stretchable. But the fact that the trial was lost yet won is the most interesting part of it, I think. Would you like to talk about that?
Yes, I want to tell you something about prosecution, who was William Jennings Bryan,
yes,
the presidential candidate on so many occasions. To begin with, I wanted to find out how Mr. Scopes felt about the movie and the play and the television thing that's been done, and so well known for that. He said, well, they took a great deal of liberty, both with his part, but he could understand that, and with what happened, because they had to condense it. He said he had no objection to it at all, but he did want to set the record straight, is that in the play and in the movie, the townspeople were very hostile to him.
Mm.
And he said this was not the case at all. They were very pleased that the trial was held there. They were more curious than anything else. Most of them didn't know what evolution was, and they weren't all that concerned about it. They felt it was a legal point, and any merchant there, anybody who owned property, was very pleased that the trial came because it was flooded, you know.
Well, that part was brought out in the movie.
Sleepy,
actually,
little town, yes, you know, and it was jammed. They made a great deal of money, anybody who lived there. So he went back, finally, many years later, and I said, Were there many people there? He said, yes. Oddly enough, in little towns, people don't move, and they remembered me, and I remembered them. And
yes,
he went into the drugstore where it was all planned. They called him over one night, I guess a couple of men from the university, and sat and talked to him over a soda, and he agreed to do it. Another thing which I thought was very interesting, that William Jennings Bryan, who was the heavy in the play, he said, it was really a great hero of mine, because Bryan was a great liberal, as so many people begin and end the other way. He began as a great Libel for Free Silver, and he said he had delivered the commencement address when I graduated from high school in a little town in Illinois, because that's where Scopes was from. And that's where Brian evidently was from. And many years later, they met in the courtroom. They were very friendly. As a matter of fact, William Jennings Bryan's son, who was helping his father on the prosecution, he and Scopes used to go swimming at recess. And once they delayed the trial for 45 minutes and caught hell from Darrow and the judge, Ralston, over it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brian, the great defender of the word, as you put it, have it in your book, and that's the way he was described in the...
Well, you know, he got paid for that. Scopes.
Scopes got paid for it.
He got paid for being the fall guy.
I never heard that.
Well, I have it right on tape. He told it to me. He told it to me that, in fact, he received a scholarship. I'm trying to figure what he majored in, and then he became an instructor, whether it was biology or...
You just said math, didn't you, Richard?
Yes, but that isn't what he turned to, because he was oil geologist.
That's right.
He's retired now, but
that's
he was...
Right. But he became an oil... it was geology.
Yes.
That's right.
University of Chicago, I believe he went through.
But that was a scholarship.
Yeah.
And that was given to him as his prize for being the fall guy for the trial.
That's unusual. I never heard
of that. He said it on the air.
Fantastic.
No.
And Darrow himself, for me, the hero of the piece, actually, over and above Scopes, And also, maybe I'm being too caught up with the play. I feel that I am. Those are the two giants, Darrow and Brian.
Well, now, Scopes wouldn't agree. He would say they were two of the giants. But, and the attorney's name escapes me, and I really should remember it, because he was the one who defended, you help me, John. Darrow defended Loeb and Leopold. This man defended Harry K. Thaw and the Thaw White Nesbitt killing. And he engineered this trial. More than Darrow is what Scopes... Now, what is his name? Very faint with three names. Like
well, you have a Dudley
days.
Field Malone.
Dudley Field Malone.
Yeah.
Right.
Is that the one you mean?
That's right. And Mr. Scopes told me that he was just as important in that trial. Uh-huh. But that I believe that Darrow did do the summation to the jury, which was his strong point as an attorney. Mm-hmm. I've talked to Darrow about Darrow with a number of people. I knew Jerry Giesler quite well, who was a great admirer of his. And Giesler, yes, Giesler was the assistant attorney when Della Rogers St. John's father, who was a very famous trial lawyer in California, defended Clarence Darrow when he was up for jury tampering. Giesler,
never knew that.
Oh yes,
isn't that amazing?
Yes, he was.
That's a man that I would have.
They tried to railroad him many times.
I love that.
They never showed that in the movie.
Which movie?
Well, that was nothing to do with the Scopes trial.
Yeah,
that's
Orson
that.
Welles played him. And
yeah, I'm
going to
have somebody. Yeah, in the next book
Newman.
I do, associated with Darrow, and that's Nathan Leopold.
I'd like to ask this question. In the play, they make a great big point of William Jennings Bryan, who was given a different name in the play, just standing there after having been beaten down by, quote, Darrow, who simply stands and gives out the names of different parts of the Bible. One name, right? Leviticus, John. He keeps Acts, you know, all the way through. And he's left gibbering up there on the stand. You yourself say that the guy was really put upon and completely thrown by Darrow. How much truth is there to that?
Well, Scopes agreed to that. He said he was, at the end of the trial, a beaten and very embarrassed man. I said, well, this is another point. I said, did the crowd turn against him? He said, no, and that's why he explained to me. The crowd, he said, was not against me to begin with. They just sat there curious. He said, if anything, they were quite kind to him. They felt very embarrassed by this man who had been a very great man.
He was
truly
indeed
a great man. Yeah. And who had given such an absurd performance here in this courtroom.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was his cross
he
of silver.
He died within days later.
Yeah, a week later, supposedly. But wasn't that cross of gold, cross of silver, cross of gold
cross
speech?
Cross of gold speech. You shall not crucify
yes,
mankind
that was the famous
upon a cross
thing.
Of gold. Pressed down upon the brow of labor, this crown of thorns.
I heard his voice many years later, and it was not that great. The great gold-voiced orator, which he was called.
Well, what maybe could it be the recording, too?
It could have been that, yes. Other person who intrigues me, and you notice that I've not given you an actor. I've gone not with Lindbergh and with the, you know.
Well, I like those people.
It's all right. Now, this Christine Jorgensen is my next character, who
well,
I think
I know
is really... for me, one of the most interesting historic figures, if you will. Say something, since
figures,
you're all
yeah.
grins. Go ahead.
Well, I'm not grinning. I don't think there's anything funny.
Have you interviewed her, John?
Who's that?
Christine Jorgensen. Well, she's making the circuit
now. She has
now.
A book
Yeah,
out.
She's
yeah.
written a
is
book.
Is the book out already?
Yeah, I saw it in a bookstore. I don't know if it's officially published, but I saw
What's
it.
The name of it?
My story or
Who
my autobiography.
Who published it?
Erickson.
Gee, I'm surprised because I've done possibly more books of Paul Erickson's than anybody
Maybe
else.
Maybe it's
and I've
not
never
officially
even got a copy.
Published now.
You're but kidding. If you've seen it in the
Oh,
bookstore,
they have it sometimes weeks before
right.
it's officially published.
Yes, I know, but we usually get a copy of it that early. Mm-hmm. And I haven't heard a word.
No, there's a very flattering picture of her on the cover. That's what caught my eye because I went out
You
there.
Referred to as her?
Why, of course.
Well, listen,
well,
she's
you?
Got a birth certificate
she
and a passport.
A... Sure, she's her.
I'm not going to argue with the State Department.
No,
sure.
I'm not arguing at all.
Well,
yeah.
yeah. no, to be gentle, because
I didn't know.
The guy
lady.
Or gal chooses to be called a she. Let's call
I felt
it
I was
she.
With a woman, really.
Yes.
You know, I went
well,
out
is
with...
Is she attractive?
Well, she's not unattractive. No, she's not unattractive.
Would you like to date her?
No, she's really not my cup of tea.
I had to say.
I went out to see her in Massapequa.
Are we still on, wait, hold
what
on.
Are you doing out there?
Can you excuse me a minute? Are we still on the air because this just fell out? What is this? It hit me in the knee. This cockamamie equipment you have here from 1912.
Well, to tell you something, every studio I've worked, you always complain. This is the most
right,
modern equipment
hang.
In the
let
entire
it hang
nation.
There on the floor. It's a plug of some kind. It looks
well,
very important.
On the mic. It
looks like an Alex Corda plug. This whole studio looks like H.G. Wells anyway.
Would you mind?
We're leaving. The spaceship is taking off now. Star Trek.
Whatever happened to Christine Jorgensen?
Oh, yes. Listen, whatever happened to Johnny Reventini? You're laughing. You remember who that is? Johnny Reventini?
No.
That's Johnny's little... Call for Philip Moore. He's in the book, too.
That's right.
Okay, that's enough. Okay, I just... Settle back here and let you two talk about Christine Jorgensen. It should be very interesting. I'll just sit here and throw in a little side.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Take it, Roy. Tell us why she's a lady.
Let me answer your question. Is
Please,
I was going out to interview her in Massapequa, Long Island, and I had been to the movies that afternoon with Dorothy Parker, God rest her soul, who was a friend of mine. And she said, "Who are you going to interview next, dear?" And I said, "Christine Jorgensen." She said, "Now, that is someone I would like to meet." And Dorothy Parker didn't particularly want to meet anybody.
That's right.
She said, "I really would love to meet her." And I said, "Well, I'm sure she'd like to meet you." So when she comes in, she says, comes in. Where is she?" I said, "Massapequa, Long Island." She said, "What's she doing there?" And I said, "Well, she's living with her mother." She said, "Oh. What sex is she, dear?" So I told her
my girl.
On the program to Christine Jorgensen, who has very little humor about herself, I will warn you. She comes on, and she wasn't sure. She said, "Well, I've always wondered about Dorothy Parker." She said, if she disliked women. She said, "I always, suspect people, women who dislike women." I think most women dislike women. And she said, "Oh, really? I don't think so." I said, "Well, I want to argue with you because you've been both, you see. I've only been one, I don't know." She said, "No, I haven't, really. She said, you see, I've always been a woman. I've always really been a woman."
Well, what age?
What your outer shell is.
When was this surgical procedure performed? At what age?
Well, I don't know the years. And she's 41,
no.
I think now, she told me.
Was she 25 or 20
no,
at the
no.
time?
It was only about 11 or 12 years ago.
Oh.
But it was something like
2 years.
Have you
ever seen her perform? Is she a real good entertainer?
I thought she was rather clever. I saw her in a club
on
the West Coast. She sings and tells jokes and takes questions from the audience. She has some stage presence. It is funny. It is funny.
I like to have seen her play at a few nightclubs I played and take questions from the audience. Are you really? Blackout. Bang. Kill the mic. Off. Funny, usually people like that have a good sense of humor, but I guess she doesn't.
She's very defensive about it.
Well, she really shouldn't be.
No, she said, well, what were you? You were not a man. She said, no, I was really always a woman.
Well,
I said,
wasn't
would you be
woman.
What you would call a homosexual? She said, no, people think that of me, but she said, actually, and she said, homosexuals.
No. You have a personality in your book who has gone down in show business history as being much maligned, alas, a la Sonny Tutt. That's Bobby Breen.
Yeah, and that's really too bad because I know Bobby, and he still performs.
Yeah.
There's a perfect example of somebody who works all the time. You know,
mm-hmm.
he's on the road most of the time, working very hard, and I don't think that he needs to because his money was very well invested for him.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a rather tough life, and he makes no bones about talking about it, being
yeah.
a child star. I asked him, you know, what it was like. He said the pressures were awful. People talk about... they said, you know, Shirley Temple didn't know she was a star. Remember we used to read those things in the 30s? Shirley
yeah.
Temple didn't know she was a... She thought every little girl went to a movie studio and went to school afterward in a little red schoolhouse. He said, well, I don't know about Shirley, but I knew exactly what my pictures cost because it was independent production at RKO. Bobby Breen owned his own pictures. And they used to say to him, Bobby, we've got to get this in so many takes. Because
yeah.
if we don't, we're going to go into overtime. And that's coming out of your bank account, baby.
Mm.
So let's see if we can get this in one take. Well, that's to a boy 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. You can imagine what it does to the psyche.
Yeah.
Well, he doesn't make no bones about it. It did. He said, look, I'm a nervous wreck. And I said, well, I am too. And I wasn't a child star with a big bank account. And he said, well, you're better off.
I noticed also in your book you have some people who have got away. Primo Canera.
Yeah.
An old favorite of mine, Misha Auer.
Misha Auer died, I think, about 3 weeks after the book came out.
Yeah. And
they were the
was,
only two.
He was so great. He had such a great face.
Yeah.
I have a theory about people, a couple of theories about people like Misha Auer or anybody who's, in my opinion, lucky enough to become a star in the motion picture screen, particularly the movies. One, they never die. People famous on the motion picture screen never die. They'll always be in front of you. You know, there's no such thing as you're ever really forgetting a Clark Gable or a Bogart or a Gary Cooper. You'll always be reminded of them through the years by old movies being reissued and reissued again.
Well,
for instance, Gone with the Wind, which is a very good example. It's
coming out again?
Yeah, coming out again. It opens at Lowe's State here in New York for I don't know how many times. This time, souped up with the 70mm print, full stereophonic sound, and probably the only living star left in the film is Olivia de Havilland. Everyone else is gone, including
the director.
That's
right. I talked to
director.
A friend of mine at MGM today about the film, and I said, when it comes out, let me know, and we'll get together and do a show with Butterfly McQueen, who is still around.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll plug the movie. He said, well, I'll give you Evelyn Keyes, too. She's in the movie, and she's around,
oh,
and
yeah.
people wonder what happened to her. And
well, I think of course, Evelyn Keyes, Butterfly McQueen, were very good in the film, but they weren't...
Oh, they weren't the stars.
They weren't
no,
the stars.
But they are the only
you know,
people
Gable, Leslie
living.
Howard,
sure.
Libby de Havilland.
They're all dead. Thomas...
Thomas Mitchell.
Yeah.
But
you said you wouldn't forget them because they're... But, you know, your children, your grandchildren won't either because these kids are watching The Late Show. Well, there was a W.C. Fields Festival. There's always seems to be one in New York, but at the Gallery of Modern Art, and I went because it was... His son and his grandson were there, you know, going to tell stories on the stage about him. And it was mostly young people. I couldn't get over it. And I've been to the
there
New
are a lot of young people who love
nuts about Fields.
Memorabla
you know, really.
And old films.
Yeah.
And
Laurel and Hardy, I think, are as popular today
yeah.
as they were.
Yeah, Laurel and Hardy. And people go to, as you said, the museums to see the old films. Even some going back to the silence. And some of the people you have in your book really fit my conception of whatever happened to. One that was out of left field is Joan Leslie.
Oh, yeah.
It was always such a pretty girl. I enjoyed her on the screen. I wonder what Irene Rich, Phoebe Daniels, perhaps I was a little more tuned in because they went to England and stayed there. And every once in a while, because I read Variety.
If you read Variety, so you're in the business,
so,
you would
yes.
know.
And the trade papers. But generally, I say I wondered about Richard Arlen. I kind of see once in a while on television and in a Parsons movie.
Yeah. He does those cheapies. I think
yeah,
it's Paramount does
yeah.
Westerns.
Yeah.
They make one or two a week.
I remember as a kid, Gail Sondergaard always used to frighten me. I always expected her to
she always
do
played villains. That's right.
Yeah, well, I've got some very good news about Gail Sondergaard because... a number of them I've interviewed, you know, I've become quite friendly with. You can't help liking some
right.
more than others. And I always thought her case was a particularly tragic one, yes, because she was one of my favorite character actresses. Yes. She and Ann Revere, two of the top character women in Hollywood, both careers ruined because of the blacklisting. And
Larry Parks, too.
Larry Parks, too, mm-hmm, yeah. And Gail Sundegaard is right now in Milwaukee at that theater, and I can't think of the name of it, famous workshop theater. Time, mm-hmm, is always doing a thing on it. Tyrone Guthrie is in Milwaukee.
Oh, in Minneapolis.
Minneapolis, I'm sorry.
Right, Minneapolis.
She's doing a number of plays out there.
Yeah, good.
And her husband, Herbert Biverman, told me a couple of months ago that he had sold two screenplays to theater guilds who were producing them for, yeah, I think, under United Artists release.
Yeah.
Gail Sundegaard's a very nice person. Politics aside, I like, yeah, her very much, and I'm glad she's back.
I saw her. Why don't you ask a question? Because I'll just... My throat's giving away, and I have another full performance to give.
Little Wonder.
Tomorrow in a little theater off Times Square.
Barbara Soule and Olin Levy.
Yes, I go now and look at my old pictures of Ruby Keeler, who is also in the book.
Richard, I've often wondered, although this is not in your book, and I guess someday you might have it, whatever happened, the true story of what happened to Uncle Don? Do you know?
No, Uncle Don is dead. He died in Florida a number of years ago, but can I say Barry Gray on this show? Barry Gray told me that he died swearing that that never happened. You're referring to what was said on the air when he thought he was off the air.
I just got a sandwich. I didn't hear the beginning of this.
Do you remember the Uncle Don story?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, maybe we better tell it for people who don't remember.
Well,
because he was a local
person. Tell the whole thing.
Believe it.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
And he read the comics, wasn't it?
No, you're thinking of LaGuardia.
Well, see, I'm from the Midwest, so we didn't get Uncle Don there.
I remember as a child, I used to listen to Uncle Don religiously. I remember that practically anything that man said, I would do. If he said, I remember one thing comes to my mind, a Greenwich Savings Bank. He used to say, he used to send you these little banks, little toy banks, with his picture on it, and every day, in those days it wasn't every day, but whenever you have an extra penny, put it in the Greenwich Savings Bank, and he used to try to get us to be thrifty, and he also, I think, they have a television program today called Birthday House, revolves around a child's
birthday. Sure, Paul Tripp does it, who was Mr. I Imagination on television.
Right. Now, Uncle Don, this goes back, I would say 30 years that I can recall.
A long time ago, yes.
Would have the parent write in, tell about the child's birthday, and I remember him saying, today is Robert Frankel's birthday, and if he'll look under the bed in the grandfather's bedroom, he'll find a present there. And how would this man know that my present was there? Over the radio, you know. And this is the type of thing he was doing. I remember he used to sing these little funny songs. Didn't really make any sense. They were pleasant to listen to. He'd play the piano, Shades of Big Wilson, while he was on the air. And used to call his car. I remember he used to call that the Puddle Jumper. So I have so many pleasant memories of Uncle Don. And then I can't recall when. I would assume it was in the early 40s.
I don't know exactly when. You're talking about the demise now, aren't you?
Yes. All of a sudden, he was abruptly off the air. I don't know whether I either outgrew him, or he was put off, or he got off. I don't know.
Well, he supposedly thought he was off the air. I don't know whether, the story is complete.
This is the story of
he was supposedly off the air when he made this very...
that will hold the little blanks for another week.
That's what I heard.
Yes,
and so, and it did go over the air. They say it might very well have. By this time, it's been pushed and kicked around so much that I wouldn't know why.
I heard
he really
was on
said.
For a year. I heard that there was something slipped. Something he said slipped.
Yeah.
But I heard that he was on a year after this occurred. Now, I don't know.
Well, someone at OR, Jim Thibodeau, who is doing a book, I understand, on radio, told me this.
Is that right?
He said that he was not fired after that. Now, he didn't tell me he didn't say it. He said he was not fired after that. He continued.
Yes.
Barry Gray told me that, he said, you know where he is? I said, yes, he's dead. He said, you're right. He died in Florida.
What was his last name?
I don't know, but he said that. You can get a book, Radio's Golden Age. It'll tell you his name.
Is that right?
But he said he didn't say it. He swore it. He never said it.
And I'll tell you, a man is still alive who was his manager. And everybody has an idea, because it's an apocryphal story, that this is why he went off the air. He was on the air for a year after this alleged happening didn't take place. Mm-hmm. There is absolutely no truth to the story. He was working in those days in Studio 6. Today is considered Studio 1 on the 24th floor of that building. There are twin studios. They are hung studios. In other words, you have to go up steps to go in them. There was supposed to be the acoustics were superior and all that. Two studios are hung. It's the only way I can describe it to you. Architecturally, I don't know exactly what that means. Mm-hmm. But when you go out of the studio, you have to go down a step. When you go in, you have to go up a step. And there was a little area. There's the engineer's area on one side, then there's a hallway, and on the other side is where the sponsors would sit. Well, when he was working, he would have three or four children and their parents there, which would be a very crowded area, and they would announce their birthday and all. Now, when they were through, somebody would go over, and if you go over there, you'll still find the hardware that's necessary to put a roller shade in. A regular window roller shade, and they would pull that shade down. That was the end of the show for the kids, so they'd get out and they wouldn't be coming up. And there's no doubt, because I know engineers who worked with them over there, Walter McDonough, and Jack Keane, and people like that. And when they were off the air, possibly sometimes, as a guy may joke around, he might have made the remark, but this was never on the air, never heard by the parents or never heard by the kids, if he said it. But the apocryphal story leads us to believe that he said it on the air, and that was the end of his career. This is completely untrue, and I cannot think of the name of the man who wrote an excellent book, very small book, but it was a whole life story of Uncle Don.
Well, did he retire? He just went off by himself, or what was it?
It just bombed out.
Just bombed out. What about what year would you know that, John?
No, I wouldn't know. And I had this book, and a friend of mine, Sal Tepper, who was an agent. Sal was in, I was living at the time in Tudor City. And it was brought to my attention that right across the street at Grand Central Hospital, Sal Tepper had been rushed into the hospital and he had had a heart attack. And after three or four days, I went over to see Sal, and he said, I heard you talking about that book that was written. I had the author on. And he said, you know, I'd love to read that book. So I went out to try to buy it because I wanted to keep it for myself, and I couldn't find the book. It wasn't around. So in turn, I loaned him my copy, and unfortunately he died about 4 or 5 days later, and you know, it's one of those things, you never got the book back, because it was a book I always wanted to keep. It was a very interesting book. It gave you, there's so many things about this guy, Uncle Don, the type of money he made, the type of life that he led. There are some people that were quite critical of some of the things that he did, which no doubt many people are critical of the things that I did, and possibly rightfully so. But towards the end of his career, and if his career, if there is a reason that you might say that his career was coming to an end, was the fact that he had a problem with alcohol.
Is that right?
And before he would go on many times, they would go down to Dunhall's and go in the kitchen, and they would make oatmeal for him, instant oatmeal, you know, something that took very fast. And I don't know enough about the problem of the, I don't want to call him an alcoholic, let's say a lush, because I think there's a great difference. This is not like the guy would drink for days at a time, but he would just have too much. And they would try to sober him up with
Oatmeal.
And the book, I thought, was excellent. And I'm just so embarrassed. I don't remember the fellow's name, because I've thought about it many times. I was hoping maybe he would have a book left. I think the book was too early.
Uncle Don's last name, if you didn't say it.
What was it?
Connie.
That's right, yeah. Who'd you get it from?
Somebody called Howie.
Do you recall how long he was on the air, John?
No.
When he, because I remember...
What he did do, though, he made a fortune and went through a fortune in no time flat. As I remember, and I don't know if I'm 100% correct, it seemed that he had a few minor difficulties with wives.
Mm-hmm. The reason I brought it up, because I can remember that he was my first radio personality, the first person, I guess, in show business.
Did you like him better than William Prince?
Well, actually, I
never met Uncle Don on a farm.
Never met Uncle Don.
Oh, yeah, there's Uncle Don. Get up off that thing.
Well, listen, who was the first one you remember listening to besides yourself on the air?
Abe Lincoln. I can remember all his speeches. I met him in the park once.
You met him in the park.
I said, get rid of the beard. You'll never go anywhere with it.
And he subsequently shaved it.
Are you kidding? Later went on to become the Smith Brothers.
I think Danny made his own recordings and listened to them as a child.
Right. I had no idols. We didn't need sound in our day. We had faces.
But Danny, you told me.
We didn't have television.
Norma Talmadge, remember?
Yeah.
You said you loved Norma Talmadge. I remember that.
Was your favorite. I know.
It was Norma Talmadge, I'm telling you.
May Bush happened to be one of my favorites. And, you know, all this time he's saying, I'm kidding about William Prince. One of the names that I once used when I was a kid, I played in Luna Park, Coney Island. I used the name Paul Prince. I don't know, I think I saw it on the back of a tobacco can or something. Paul Prince, it sounded good. Paul Prince, it flowed. You know, easy name to remember.
But your real name is Crystal, though.
Yeah, well, that's not my real name. I told you the story before on the air, but it's so
thought it was
hilarious. I know it bears repeating. And I'm not telling you to keep our announcer awake. But I had the same name as a famous movie star, and I had to change my name to Crystal. Or, you know.
Are we going
to
learn what your name was?
Your name is Crystal.
No, my real name isn't Crystal. My real name is the same name as a famous star, and I had to change it because one of the
names.
Yeah, we want to know.
David. Now, you big mouth, you know.
We had to ask him.
Great straight man. Then he does all the old jokes like, I'm not famous now, but someday you'll read about me. I smoke in bed.
Oh, baby.
He'll ask me to do my impression of the Australian, which is a sight gag, another thing I bomb on radio with. It's good Carnegie food.
How was that cake?
Tell us how you got your name.
It's my real name.
Because I thought.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yes, and I tried when I was a kid. I tried other names, you know.
Like, why? It's a great name, why. Danny Crystal. Easy, looks great on a marquee.
I tried
in small letters.
Very small letters. Boy, when Claudia Pinza gets billed over here, you're in a lot of trouble. The daughter of Ezio Pinza. I worked with her. I worked with a lot of great stars in my day.
Whatever happened to Danny Crystal?
What?
Whatever happened to Danny Crystal?
Whatever happened? Well, I'm hoping you'll put me in the
room. Would any of you fellas like to join me in one chorus of Uncle Don's theme song?
Love,
I don't remember it.
What is it?
Do you remember?
Let's see. Hello, little kids, hello. I keep thinking of da 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 dum, da 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 da.
Well, it goes hippity gip, hot sa, ringbo re, Sibonius gibbity, high low d.
Now it's coming back to me.
Honky coke doke with an alakazan.
Sing this song.
Dan or Kazan?
Kazan.
Sing this song with your Uncle Don.
Right. Now I remember it.
Wonderful.
God, 30 years ago.
Can you do the Let's Pretend?
No, I don't. I haven't watched
any. Wheat is so good to eat, and we have it every day. As far as I can.
I don't. I don't watch the kiddie programs anymore. For the past 6 months, anyway.
Yeah.
Let's Pretend was first radio.
No,
I heard that
be.
On radio. Yeah.
I think it was always radio.
Like
I
that
believe.
Anymore. Yeah.
Do we?
So you did, or did you mean how did I? How would I find her? Is
right.
That what you
right.
Mean?
Yes.
Well, that's very hard to answer. Everyone asks me that. The only generalized answer is that I know where most of the people are.
Oh, I see.
Now, I have to go back 2 or 3 years if you say, well, how did I find out? I don't know. You see, I've had this idea for such a long time because I was always curious myself of what happens to people.
Yeah.
So whenever there'd be a small clipping in the paper saying so-and-so, who was once a silent film star, fell and broke her leg or was arrested today for shoplifting, I always made a mental note. Well, she lives in Massachusetts, you know.
Yeah.
So that when I started to do this, it was much easier for me than for most people, because I have a very good memory, for one thing. And then when I first went to California, I used to live in Hollywood, my introduction to motion pictures was through silent stars. Mm-hmm. One of the first people I met, who was born on my birthday, was October 5th, was Louise Dresser, who is dead now, but she played the Tsarina in the Valentino picture, The Eagle. Mm-hmm. She also made out in many other silent films, but she introduced me to people, and I knew Eileen Pringle once very well. She lives in New York now. She was in 3 weeks and His Hour with John Gilbert, and she's a very big silent star. And knowing her, you know, you could be sitting in her living room, she'd say, "Oh, here comes Anna May Wong. She's coming for tea."
I see.
And although I had no idea of doing anything like this at that time, because that was 10 or 15 years ago, I remembered a lot of the stories they told me, and it's easy, you know, if you know Leatrice Joy, to call her up and say, "Do you know where Anna Q. Nielsen is?"
It's sort of a chain reaction.
Yeah, because most of them, if they don't keep in touch, they have an idea. They say, "Well, I know she married a man, they moved to Florida, and they bought a hotel in Key West," or something like that.
In the sketch you do on Gabriel Heater, now, I don't recall whether I read this, or it's possibly not him that I read it about, but I recall reading that Gabriel Heater had a lot of hang-ups, one of which was that he was afraid to be out in public, or afraid to leave his studio, and in his later years, while he was still on the air, on a national hookup, he had a lot of persecution complexes. Now, has anyone here heard of this, or is it? Or do I have the wrong commentator? Now, I don't know whether it was. I think it's Gabriel Heater, and I think I read it. Now, does this strike a?
Not at all. The only ring of familiarity it has to me is that I know Bill Stern, who was on that same network.
No, that wasn't Bill Stern.
It was disturbed at one time.
I know that. It was definitely not.
I know nothing about this with Gabriel Heater. Maybe his brother's listening. Lives in New York.
John, have you
heard it? Attorney.
No. You've never heard it in my life. In fact,
I met
his son, and in fact, Gabriel Heater had on the road with him a fellow who used to be my engineer, who had the Chinese Junk for many years, which he owned, which used to be up at the Bronx.
Or, oh, sure. You know. I used to see it up in...
And the man traveled all over, made many, many personal appearances. I don't think that this is true at all.
I apologize. It must be someone else.
He began as a boy orator, so he must have developed in the latter years.
It was the latter years, whoever it is.
You know who we spoke for as a boy orator?
No.
When William Randolph Hearst ran for mayor of New York, which was, 1911 or something, at that time, boy orators were very popular. And that was his job, going around and speaking, gathering crowds to speak for Hearst, who lost.
Another one who got his start that way was Joey Adams.
Really?
Not that far back through LaGuardia.
Were boy orators in at that time?
Well, no. He used to do political speeches on the corner, and LaGuardia met him and became very fond of this youngster at about the age of 11 or 12, and paid for his tuition in college even. Yeah. It's Joey Adams. Joey will tell you the story. Have you ever heard that story? Did it on the air. No? He was a discovery of LaGuardia.
He was always very politically oriented. He was always hanging around. Joey Adams.
Yes, but in other words, this is something that came to him because of his interest in LaGuardia, and LaGuardia's interest in him, which was one. Roy, you have some questions.
Yes, I think one of the most important radio teams that extant is Amos and Andy, and I think they were probably the last of the white men who did Negro characters. I may be wrong in that, but certainly one of the most important and loved by both the white and the Negro community. I think if you're going to really talk about people who are, what shall I say, people who typified a group or started something or were classics, I guess that's the best word, classics of their kind, it would certainly be the Amos and Andy duo who gave us so many marvelous characters. You have them here in your book. Did you meet them?
Yeah, I've met them, not when I was doing the book, but my first job in this business was with CBS, and they were still on the air at that time. It was in the last days of radio. I think they had what they called the Amos and Andy Music Hall. It was when they were interviewing people and playing records. It was a different format entirely.
This is the TV you're talking about.
No, this is radio.
Still radio.
Yeah, because they ended radio like that. They were not doing the five a week thing anymore. And I used to go up to their office and meet them. I had no intent of writing a book at that time, you know. And I knew their producer. And I got the impression from him even then that they were becoming very bitter about the criticism that was leveled against them because...
I didn't know about that. What was the criticism?
Yes.
I didn't know about that.
The civil rights groups had for many years tried to take them off the air.
I never knew.
Many years.
See, I was wrong.
They found them offensive, right? Well, you know. Said people of both races, and that's true. I know a number of Negroes who love Amos and Andy.
That's right.
But civil rights groups were dead against them. And as their power grew, and Amos and Andy were getting older, too, they finally got... CBS denies that they took the television series out of circulation, which it is, you know. It is now no longer for sale. You cannot buy it. If you have a station in Buffalo and you want to put Amos and Andy on there, you can't buy it. But they deny it is because of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Gosden and Carell did not play the characters, they were played by Negroes, but the civil rights groups found them still very offensive.
Mm-hmm. At the very height of the radio success, I don't think there was maybe two families in the whole country that didn't tune them in. They were here to hear that theme song, and they knew exactly where Lightning was, and then all the rest of the characters, Madam Queen and Kingfish. It was
fantastic. If you remember this. Remember when Andy was sued for breach of promise by Madam Queen?
Oh, yes.
And they had the trial.
Absolutely.
And I remember going downtown. Now, I don't know what year this would have been. It probably in the 30s, I guess. Downtown with my grandmother one night when the stores were open. And they were broadcasting Amos and Andy, which we were used to listening to, throughout J.L. Hudson, which is like Macy Company here. This is in Detroit. And I said, why is the radio being played? I was a little boy, in here. She said, why, no one would go downtown tonight. Andy is on trial
for
breach of promise with Madam Queen. And we walked outside, and for those in the street, they had loudspeakers, as they used to, when war would break out or a president would die. They had loudspeakers on all the streets. And I think I said in the book that you could walk down the street on a nice night in the summer.
I didn't read your, I did that part, but...
And it would come out of every house. It was
absolutely.
Like it was piped in.
Yes.
For the whole neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I've told this to the boy who works for me. He's only 16. He doesn't understand. You have no conception of how popular they were. There's nothing on television.
Nothing on television that could equal
They were hands down the kings of
the
radio.
The kings. And Calhoun would come on this ridiculous character they developed. Wasn't he marvelous? The show off, his ego,
the alley lawyer.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And Needle Nose Fletcher and Miss Blue. Remember Buzz Me, Miss Blue?
Oh, great. Yeah. Who could forget? I mean, these lines are, by this time, I mean, they're legends. They're part of the Americana scene. You can't just say these things without, affecting a great many people of that.
You know what's the toughest trivia question in the world if you play the trivia game and you're quite good at it? What was on opposite Amos and Andy? I don't know.
I would not know.
Tough question.
They must have just played soft music somewhere for those people. Who were they?
Who would have bought the time?
No one would have bought the time. There must have been sustaining, and they just let the old thing, the records go, I would imagine. But these characters were so definite, and just these two guys did all, 14 characters? How many were there?
Well, there were at least that many. Because they were bringing people in. There was...
Brother Crawford.
Brother Crawford, yes.
And,
who was the Stephen Fetchin character again? What was his name?
Lightning.
That was,
yeah.
Lightning, yes. Oh, yes, and then Amos would, he would say to Andy, and then Amos is, am I getting them right? No, Andy's voice would be down there. He would talk like something like, and the other one would be up where there somewhere. Yeah, he was pure gold,
the reason why he probably was so popular, among other things, is that radio was king, too. There
you know,
was no TV.
Amos
TV
and Andy.
And
great.
Who
really?
Does?
Who's he?
Who does?
Amos.
Do
it.
Well,
really?
Well, let's hear you
does.
Do it.
Yeah,
well,
I'd like to hear
a little bit.
Well, hello there, Brother Andy. What are you all doing now?
All right, let's, folks, send the postcards and letters into Long John.
That's quite good.
And
isn't
let's
it?
See
yeah.
if we can get
He's
Ted Mack
excellent.
Interested in.
Just
right.
excellent.
That was six on the applause meter. And next we
Why,
hear
it's Joe Lurie Jr.
It's the tap dancing of Mary Jones, who has come all the way from Inglewood to do her little. Okay, kid, the hook. And next
one little bit I did. Look, he goes one little lousy bit I did. And he goes, I
John really did that just so he could lead me into.
You're sure leaving out that line that he used to do, around and around she goes, and where she
and
stops,
she
nobody
stops,
knows.
Nobody knew where he went yeah. there for a while.
Don't they still do it?
I remember I heard Frank Sinatra.
Does Ted Mack do that?
Ted Mack with the Jared
Mack.
He doesn't do that, does he?
One goal.
I heard Frank Sinatra
here.
On Major Bowes. He won a Major Bowes contest. Frank Sinatra.
Jared Blood?
Yeah.
There's a line for you. Whatever happened to Frank Sinatra after last night?
Oh, nothing. Absolutely
nothing.
Nothing
is right. He's in great shape.
Is he?
Oh yeah.
Whatever happened to Frank Parker?
Frank Parker's on our show many times.
And what is he doing? Is he singing?
Where he was Lou Parker. They went out together as a team out the Midwest. I haven't seen Lou in a while either. Frank Parker's very, very successful.
Well, I know he was at one time, but I haven't.
Lou Parker is out on the coast, and I think he's married to Jane Keene. Betty Keene.
Betty.
And he did that series on TV last season. Right.
And who did he used to sing with on the Godfrey
show?
Yeah, who did he? What was the female?
Hmm?
Jeanette Davis, the other one.
Jeanette Davis.
I can tell you about Jeanette Davis.
No, what was the name of the? They used to sing some beautiful duets.
Pretty girl, big brown eyes.
Yeah, dark.
Oh, I know. She married.
Anita Bryant?
Nope.
No, Peck or something. The producer of the show afterwards.
Yeah.
After.
Yeah.
What's his name gave the Godfrey show up? Irving Mansfield gave it up.
Mm.
And then she.
You know who I mean then?
Yeah, no, I can't think
of her
name.
Can't think of her name.
She was much
Light opera.
Light opera.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is she still active? Whoever she is she.
Not that I know of. I got in touch.
Do you know
with,
who we mean?
I do. I know who you mean. I don't know. I got in touch with Jeanette Davis. So there's someone who turned me down a few weeks ago.
Right.
She's living out on Long Island. She was very pleasant, but she said, I have children and I'm married and I'm happy and I never want to work again. And I have no reason to do an interview show, and I'm very pleased that you asked me, and I'm flattered. And ask me again in 5 years, maybe I'll change my mind. But she's the voice, by the way, on the Carolina Rice commercial, you know.
Really?
Carolina, the extra long gray rice.
Oh,
doesn't get a nickel for it.
I love that.
Well, why is she doing it?
That's what I said. I said, is it true that you are? I always heard this. She said, yes. I said, well, you're living off your residuals. She said, no, it was after I negotiated the contract for residuals on commercials. 48 or something.
That's
it's an old tape that she made.
Mm-hmm. Whatever happened to Glenn Gray?
Glenn Gray's dead.
Is he dead? I don't know. The Rippling Rhythms I heard from a couple of months ago. You know, Sheffield?
Sheffield, yeah.
He's in.
Yes.
No.
Oh, he was.
He's what?
In partnership with Freddie Fields, with his brother, the artist rep in California on the Sunset Strip.
Oh, yeah, he's big. Agency, creative management, creative talent.
He
managed Judy Garland, I think.
Do you know who Frank Parker used to sing with? I found this on the second program I recorded it. Harry Horlick and his A&P Gypsies.
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah, they were radio.
He's living here on Riverside Drive, Harry Horlick.
Yes. You know, those days of radio are gone and probably will never.
He never made Malt Milk, did he? Horlick's
no.
Malt, no connection with that family.
No.
See, Roy, that's why you brought up your Amos Handy.
Radio left everything to your imagination.
Absolutely.
The Witch's Tale.
I was about to say that
remember
very
Witch's
thing.
The Witch's Tale, all those great shows. No more.
That's right.
No
Marion Marlowe. That was the one that Frank said.
Now I have to watch these tired television programs, you know.
Your imagination started. Would take over with night lights out, etc.
All right, now
whatever happened to Marion Marlowe? You don't...
I don't know.
Marion Marlowe.
She
that
married that
one,
producer. Uh-huh. Precht, yeah. I think.
Well, she hung around a long while after Godfrey.
Wasn't that the way you spell it?
Did stock and everything, you know.
Bea, wasn't it? No, you never heard of the marriage? No.
Marion Marlowe and Judith DeRozan, and then, of course, later came Boone and... who else is on the show? Oh, a bunch of people.
Radio wouldn't even do tap dances
Godfrey is,
for you.
It's amazing.
Still doing
still
very,
one of the
very
last
well.
Of the radio personalities. Still on the air for...
They worked around him on the new
Columbia.
CBS news thing.
The only one that wasn't
dropped, right.
Wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, I imagine
right.
He's got a very long contract.
I would like to know what happened to that coin that George Raft was flipping when he went down in Scarface.
That coin
have you done any
to Rudy
research?
Valley. He caught it, and it never hit the ground.
It still has it?
Still has
in his mouth.
Didn't even
did
leave
you do Valley on your show?
No. He's quite active in
oh, yeah.
the
yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to George Rapp?
He's in the news quite a bit, not for professional reasons.
He was wonderful in Casino Royale. It was just a little thing, but...
Do you still have that gambling joint in London?
Right. No, that was the last thing he was in the news. They would not give him a reentry from
me. I didn't know
that.
So he's still in London?
No, he couldn't go back.
So where is he now?
He's back on the West Coast, I think. He was in partnership with George Jessel in a travel agency a few years ago when he was really down and out.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Was he down and out?
Oh, yes.
You know why they never...
He spends real good, you know.
They had a travel agency.
He lost a lot of money in Cuba.
George, did you know that, John? That George Raft and George Jessel had a travel agency at one time?
No, never.
They went out of business. They were just booked one-way trips everywhere. And they just couldn't survive. It's all just one-way trips. Train, plane, whatever you want. Never a round-trip ticket. But I like George Raft because he's a product of the type of movies and the days of the movies that are gone. The wonderful stock company that Warner Brothers had of Alan Hales and the George Rafts and Frank McHugh's and all those guys always played types. Frank McHugh.
Always the same.
Yeah, and they either played...
Good guy.
Well, Pat O'Brien, et cetera, they would play cops or they would be the bad guys.
Yeah.
Very well. The only thing that bothered me, there was one actress on the contract to Warner Brothers and...
Glenda Farrell?
No, I always thought she had the sexiest eyes in the world and she was a very good actress, and they never knew what to do with her. And
who was she?
Let her go, Pat Neal.
Patricia Neal?
Sure.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, she became very successful later.
Well, yes, but
she got
those were the golden years for her, and they didn't know what to do with that. I know they put her in some films.
Terrible pictures.
You know, I've yet to see one of those old...
Sensuous.
I've yet to see one of those old-time gangster movies where there wasn't a good kid brother who was always getting the dirty end of the stick and trying to reform everybody.
The plot was two guys that grew up together. One became a priest, the other became a gangster.
The older brother was always the bad guy who really goes wrong but has underneath his veneer, has a good heart, trying to take care of the young kid brother who hates the older brother. And finally, everything is reconciled because the kid brother comes out on top.
The mother's played by Jane Darewell.
Jane,
right?
Yeah. She died recently.
She just died
about a week or so ago.
You know, I'm going to interview tomorrow one of my favorite character actresses. I think everybody's. Margaret Hamilton.
Oh,
the Wicked Witch of the West.
She was just on a TV show. She played the medium.
Whatever happened to her since The Wizard of Oz.
She lives here in Gramercy Park. And she told me she's up for a Broadway show, which I'm glad to hear, because she's very, very talented. I really love her.
Yeah, she is very good.
Well, there's a movie coming back pretty soon that has three of the leads all dead, and only one of them is. There's four leads. Now, what film is that, would you tell me? I'll tell you what it is if you don't know.
Only four leads?
There's four leads, and three of those leads are dead.
You speaking of Gone with the Wind?
Right.
Oh, so you were going to sandwich when we talked about that.
Oh, I was having
Is Zazu Pitts still around?
No, she's dead.
Was it? Is it recently, or
who was this?
About Zazu 4 or 5 Pitts. Years ago.
You have
that long.
You have a wonderful comedian character actress, Patsy Kelly, in your book.
Oh, yeah.
One of the great...
Great face and wonderful kind of a style. Well, she works once in a while in films.
Whatever happened to Merle Oberon?
Oh, she's doing
very well. She's
very wealthy. Married very well. Lives in Mexico.
Yeah, she lives in Acapulco. Her husband is one of the big millionaires in Mexico.
Right. She comes to New York occasionally. She looks like she hasn't aged a day.
She and Dolores Del Rio have always been able to...
Yeah.
I photographed Mary Astor several years ago, but what is she doing now?
Well, I can tell you because my book has been optioned for a TV series by Flom Grinberg, the people who did the Bogart special, if you saw that.
Yes.
And the producer came here to talk to me about it, and he said, did you talk to Mary Astor? And I said, no. He said, well, we tried to get her to appear on the Bogart special, and she won't. He said, so don't bother, because I don't think she'll allow you to photograph her for the book.
As a matter of fact, it was difficult at the time.
Said, well, why? Because, you know, she made that... come back with the book and all, and she had the liquor problem, which she discussed very openly, and she beat it, and she's got good reviews on both books.
Mm-hmm.
He said, no, she says, I don't want people coming around here. People just want to see how bad I look or how old I look. Mm-hmm. And she's living, this was 3 or 4 months ago, in Leisure World, which is, I'm not sure, getting flooded with mail. It's a senior citizenship project in Laguna Beach, California, right on the ocean.
Richard, do you recall the when Jackie Gleason first started, the first Alice, his first wife?
Pert Kelton.
Pert Kelton.
My favorite. She's the best Alice they ever had.
Yes, yes, definitely. Now, I've noticed her in she's always doing the same commercial. She's doing commercials now.
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
She's got a Broadway show, too.
Yeah, she was Music Man.
Uh-huh.
What is she doing now, besides these commercials?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Really. I imagine, you know.
But she'd been around Broadway for quite a while.
Yeah, she was definitely the best.
You know, I ran into her once a long while ago, and I haven't seen her now for a few years. I was so knocked out by her with Myrna Loy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she does.
Yes,
yeah. So great.
I saw her at a matinee of Barefoot in the Park, I think. She was here on...
I think...
She was one of my favorites.
Like the Myrna Loy and William Powell pictures.
What happened to William Powell? Now, that's my boy.
I'll tell you, he'll be in the book.
Sick man now, isn't he?
No, he had a heart condition? He had cancer.
Okay.
Yes.
And he lives in Palm Springs, California.
Yeah, right.
He's married to one of the Busby Berkeley girls. Very pretty blonde. I mean, it was years ago she was a Busby Berkeley girl. And he has a refrigerated house out there. And he had, I think, a house in Beverly Hills.
Mm-hmm.
He's quite well off financially, and a lot of very white hair.
Yeah, I remember him. Yeah.
He was in a picture in, I think, something like 1926 with a friend of mine, Jacqueline Logan, who was a big silent star. It was called White Mice, and they made part of it in Cuba. I had no idea they made any film, much less a silent film in Cuba. They were on location. And she said that they had such a good time making the picture that everybody in it formed a White Mice Club, that they would always keep in touch, no matter what happened. And they always have. That's how I know where he is, because I asked her. She lives in Bedford Village.
You know, in those old-time films, there was one fellow, and I think his name is Jack Norton, if I remember right. He always played a drunk.
Yes, he's been dead quite a few years. You're right.
Was that his name?
Right name, yeah.
Oh, he did.
Yeah.
Did he ever do anything else that you know of?
Yeah, he once played a drunk, but at the end he pulled a gun, and he was the heavy.
Really?
I don't know the name of the picture, but I remember seeing it.
Was this in the middle of his drunk? He never did anything but with the drunk.
I never knew. I don't know how his career began, but he played
a drunk.
I think
he was the most incredible
acting drunk. What
else
could he play? People would laugh when he came on of it straight.
Yeah,
he was so tight.
They would expect him to be
a drunk typecast.
Richard, last minute questions for Richard?
When do you think this second book will be?
It'll be out in early spring, like March. Quite a bit of it is finished now.
It's going to be called Son of What, Whatever Became...
Whatever Became of Volume 2.
Volume 2.
Yeah.
Has this been successful, this book?
Yes, quite. It's in its fourth printing, and considering they haven't spent nickel one on it, I think it's done quite well.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, do you think it's sold primarily through your radio program?
No, because I'm only heard... to begin with, it's only on FM, and I'm only heard in New York and San Francisco and Los Angeles. I think it's through radio and TV appearances, you know, such as your show and Today's Show and the other very monitor, things I've been on, because
It had sold out the first printing, and it was well into the second before they even took an ad. This should be encouraging to anyone listening. I want to say this. If you really believe in something, because I worked like a dog for years, over a year, trying to get this book published, and even friends of mine were very discouraging about it. Maybe they meant well, but they said, you know, they didn't think it was a very good idea. And it went to 9 publishers, including Crown, which turned it down a year before, as I said, and took it a year later. They really should go ahead and don't listen to your friends, your family. They all mean well, but if you really believe it, go ahead and do it. It really taught me a lesson. I'll never let anyone talk me out of anything again.
This is true. That there's a lot of books. Wasn't Peyton Place one that went around?
So it was the greatest story ever told.
Yes, Fulton Adverse. Mm-hmm.
32 publishers or something.
Well, the one I wrote, Anthony Adverse, I had a lot of trouble with it. Nobody could lift it. And they said, it won't sell, it's too heavy. The book is too heavy. But I pursued, and I ended up writing, you know, many other things. After that, most of it pornographic. My mind took a sudden turn for the worse. What the devil am I talking about? But Richard, about your book, I look forward to volume 2, and it's a very entertaining book, and if anybody has any curiosity at all about the famous and the infamous, and some are, or like memorable, or just like things like looking at... Like looking at
memorabilia, I think.
Yeah, I was just trying to think. I thought it was the name of an actor.
Today, yesteryear, and
he's really sleepy.
Like a Lone Ranger commercial.
I don't know. I just like your book, and I'll be very happy to have you lay the volume 2 on me, even if we don't do the show. Send me a copy. I put them on the shelf. They go right there, the 2 copies, and then there'll be volume 3. And said one day I'll have to. Move
what
out.
A corny
bit of apartment because there'll
Danny,
be too many volumes.
It's the corniest speech I've ever heard you
really?
Make. Yeah.
Well, it's 3:30. I'm a little punchy. It's been a long day.
Can I have a cigarette?
If you want, no.
Can I have a cigarette?
Not after that last remark, you don't. I'll let you smoke this bed. No, I'll give you a cigarette, Roy. That's a penny. You want that put on your American Express card?
Let me have it.
But it's a good book, Richard. I recommend it highly to those who are listening in, and I look forward now to your signing my book. Something nice, you know, a little intimate, like to Danny, who really talented and
read well in court. So,
yes. Yeah, and I'll be like, who was the one that you said?
William Prince?
No. I never
had to get that
autographs.
In.
Never know autographs. Because one day
there may be a teenage kid who could remember you in 20 years as a kindly actor that signed the autograph with a smile. And
yes, Bela Lugosi, the famous classical line about the guy asking for Bela Lugosi's autograph. Remember that one?
No.
Came out of the stage door, Bela Lugosi. The kids are waiting for him to sign autographs. And they walked up to him with their pads, and I said, "Can we have your autograph, Mr. Lugosi? Can we have your autograph, Mr. Lugosi?" Away, got away from him. I'm sorry, I don't sign any autographs. Well, I worked with him at this Victor Theater in Bayonne, and he was the first star I ever worked with. I was just a kid. I'd breaking in the act and everything else, and a nervous wreck, and I walked up to him. I don't know what to say. Much like my story about Tallulah Bankhead. And I said to him, first thing you came around, I said, he was all dressed, ready to go on the stage with the makeup and the cape, you know, and the full dressing. I said, "Is that the same cape that you wear in the movies, Mr. Lugosi?" He said, "No, it's rented." So just for days, I really brought me down. Went to my dressing room in a little theater off Times Square. Wasn't really a dressing room, it was more like a hook. I think he was a real Nazi submarine commander. Yeah, with the turtleneck sweater and the... Yeah.
What did they say about your book?
Oh, no, he's handing me a copy of the Times today. Well, this is good news, saying that my book is dated because Gail Sundergaard is playing the cigar-smoking Claire Zakanhasi, and it's funny because the day I met Miss Sundergaard, I said, you know, a great role for you when you want to come back on the stage is The Visit, the Durinmat play, and she said, yes, it's something I'd like to do. It was 2 years ago, and I see...
She's going
to
do
Yeah, she is doing it. It's the review from Minneapolis, where we said she was now, at the Tyrone Guthrie Theater. Well, I wish her nothing but the best. She's a nice lady and a great actress.
She is that.
Good.
Oh, she's fine.
I'm glad she's back with us.
And now she doesn't scare me anymore.
No, I introduced her as Mrs. Meany. How I remember
movies,
you.
Well,
she made so many sympathetic roles, you know.
Well, she was always the, it was a very large house, and she was sort of the mistress of the house. And it was a young girl who was coming as a, usually as a companion or a nurse, very nervous, and she would say, come in, my
You're dear. Thinking particularly of Cat and the Canary, and I brought that up, and she said, you know, if you analyze that picture, I'm the only one in it who has not done anything wrong.
That's right.
She didn't do a thing. She was just spooky looking.
That's right, and, you know, I think that was the impression they were trying to give.
Well, she won the first Academy Award that was ever given to a Best Supporting Actress.
In that movie?
For Anthony Adverse, which was a very sympathetic role, and then she followed that with Madame Dreyfus. That's in The Life of Emile Zola. You can't be more sympathetic than that. And yet we remember her as Mrs. Meany.
Yeah. Well, somehow she always...
There was only very few parts that were sympathetic for that joke.
In a seance. I could just picture her leading a seance.
Well, she has that face, you know,
but it's
funny.
Did you know Eden Gray worked with Joseph Schulkraut?
No, I didn't know that.
Yes, Eden Gray... was on Broadway as a star with Joseph Schulkraut, and she also worked with Edward G. Robinson, and her husband, of course, as you know, was a very big screenwriter.
What was
Cohen.
Oh.
You remember her son.
Yes, son, I remember, was on the show.
Yeah, every time you pick up a paper, Claude Rains, all these wonderful people, can never be replaced. For me, can ever replace Gary Cooper?
No.
There's nobody around that's quite like Gable. There's nobody around.
You think we'll ever replace Al Lotman when he goes?
Oh, forget about it. Never,
never,
John.
Never,
there'll never be another Al Lotman.
I think one of the most important. I think one of the greatest.
His performance on the bridge of the River Kwai.
That's right.
His performance.
He was
that film.
Japanese general.
No, he was under the bridge. You never saw Al. But there were a lot of hand shots of him.
His hand.
His performance in that film.
Beautiful.
Masterly, masterly. I know the direction was great and the camera was mounted beautifully, but his performance.
He also did, had a lead in The Whistle during the whistling chorus.
You know that in that film, it wasn't, you know, bought out, this Academy Award. He won the Webfoot Award. Yeah, that was, you know, you tell a joke about Eleanor Holmes. She made so many pictures that she was in the water, she had webbed feet. You know, cleanliness is next to godliness, and Van Johnson was next to impossible. In every picture, he was in the water, out of the water. It was over Walter Pidgeon, always, you know, with your director's suits on. Howard Beyer was really Walter Pidgeon in disguise. It was all those. Every studio had all those wonderful stock characters that were always...
Whatever happened
pigeons.
To Greer Garson?
I just read in the paper today that they wanted her to do, just today's paper, they wanted her to do a Batman commercial. Not commercial, a thing on Batman, you know, one of those funny things they do. And Buddy Fogelson has talked her out of it. He said it's not in keeping with her image as a great actress.
I would agree. She cannot do it. Not after Mr. Benefit. What are you going to do with that? Oh, come on.
Why?
But she just can't do it. Not Greer Garson.
Burgess Meredith can do the Penguin.
Burgess Meredith.
And Liberace can be in it. And you know, it's not in keeping with his performance.
Image, is that what you're trying to look
with his image. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's ridiculous. Well, that's their opinion, but I don't think so. I think that's what makes them even greater in my eyes.
How's Jackie Vernon?
He's now in Vegas and about to do a movie.
As a star?
Carson McCullers, what the hell is the name of that
thing? Fate of the Lonely Hunter.
That's right, down south.
Being shot in Selma, Alabama.
Selma, Alabama.
Gonna eat a lot of corn pone down there for five
or
6 weeks.
He's gonna play a deaf mute.
Oh, he has no lines.
But that is gonna be... I think you'll be getting it.
Who's the star, Alan Arkin?
Arkin will be the star, but it'll be kind of a duet.
Yeah. That's his first film, huh? Good break, boy. Co-starring Alan Arkin. Hot property on the screen now. How's he doing in Vegas, Roy?
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean...
You gotta check those Keno games.
Yeah.
Well, John, you know, we've...
I think
killed
we've
wrapped
it up again.
We've killed an evening.
Yes.
About
another evening. We've gone down the drain.
Now, they,
Frank
say
Fisher,
the
do you know that Frank Fisher was our night supervisor tonight?
Yes, and the pots...
That's right. Very fine. And
very
did you
fun.
Realize that
there
we
was
had
no feedback
on the
tonight?
Console tonight, we had John Powers.
John Powers on the console.
That's
in the
right.
mighty console of NBC. Mm, play your exit music.
I think
and the organ
know.
Shoots into the wall.
I think
and
we
the
should
sun slowly
should mention our director's name.
Why?
I don't know.
All right. He's wearing his cashmere sweater. Show
I
off.
Think we should mention our announcer.
Our announcer.
John Clark.
John Clark from
right.
the little studio.
And the producer of
still
the show.
Reading the paper.
And Pecora.
Hasn't looked. And Pecora, yes.
That's right. And Anna Marie gets our
Anna
coordinator.
Anna Marie gets our coordinator, who is
yes,
our
yes.
coordinated
yes,
again.
Yes, yes. And we've had.